coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello everybody, and happy Tuesday night. Hope everybody is doing well. There is all kinds of stuff brewing in the world right now, I'm telling you. We are very excited to be bringing you a couple weeks of great shows. Our good friend, Gretchen Cornwall, the author of Templar Cave Royston, was supposed to be on the show next week. Unfortunately, she will not be able to, folks, because she's filming with National Geographic. So we never keep people from opportunities like that. Those are things that are fantastic in the world of research whenever folks like National Geographic see your work as worthy to feature, worthy to talk about whenever it comes to research into things like Knights Templar. So congratulations, Gretchen. In her stead, we will have, my list just left. There we go. We will instead have Kristen T. Harris on talking about giants in America, giant bones. There was actually a panel today that I sent him that was all about the Smithsonian changing history. And we'll get into that conversation, the whole was the Smithsonian hiding giant bones, things like that. We'll be going to Cygames next week. So the week after next, our coverage will be live on site at Cygames, the amazing event in North Carolina, first of its kind, where folks with sight abilities, remote viewers, all kinds of things, everything from precognitives to telekinesis, psychokinesis, all kinds of different disciplines compete against each other. It is really fascinating and super fun. So check it out and look out for that coverage. Our guest tonight, in the second part, is Bob Spearing. We will be talking about cases of interest with MUFON and things upcoming at the MUFON Symposium. And in the first segment, we are glad to welcome back the founder of Paradigm Research Group, Steve Bassett. The topic of conversation tonight, oddly enough, right after things got ready for this show, it was released today that contractors are now, as long as contractors in the world of black budget projects, things like that, go to Arrow or Pursue directly, their NDAs are now waived. And this was something that Congresswoman Luna called for at the big presser at the Capitol Hill a few weeks ago. Was what we really need is the president to make some kind of action against NDAs with private companies, so that, because even if they come forward to the government, it doesn't mean that they aren't punishable by the NDAs that they signed with the private entity. So welcome back to the show, Steve. How have you been, my friend?
Still here, still hanging in.
Well, as we were saying before the show, it is because of the work of good people like you over the last many decades that we are now seeing these trickles come down the line, that we are now seeing declassification of documents. And I've said on the show numerous times that it is the fact of many of these documents, yes, are not new. They've been around for a long time if you're a researcher in communities, things like that. But what it is a culling together of data from various very far-reaching sources that you'd have to look through that makes it accessible to the common person, and to the fact that over a third of the people on Earth have clicked on the Department of War UFO files, Stephen. Over a billion clicks. Like over 3
the last
billion
I
clicks.
Checked, it was a billion three, seven.
Yeah.
It was a billion seven.
Yeah, yeah. So it's and growing because they just had the fourth tranche. So with being involved in this for as long as you have, what do you make of every number one? Congratulations. You've finally started thawing something up there. But what do you make of all of these things? What do you make of the folks in the community, especially, who keep saying big nothing burger about all of this?
Well, they were always going to do that. They were always going to feel like it had to be a The frustration with the truth embargo was deep.
Yeah.
And so that was going to be the case. And so the end was always going to be like this, right? As we get close, everyone is now expecting it all. Here, I expect it now, right? And they're missing the point that something of this magnitude, which in some ways is more significant in magnitude than anything else you can think of, including the war that's going on right now in the Gulf, has to happen in a way. There has to be a way that this gets done, and it has to relatively work for the government, for the political figures, and so forth. Defense country, all that stuff. Right?
Yeah,
in other words, it's going to happen. Yeah. And to the extent that they could keep it back, hold back, they would try. But at the same time, they're having to prepare for the inevitable. So we're in the beginning of the end of disclosures in 17 really picks up in 23 and never stops after that.
Yeah.
In terms of the hearings, in terms of legislation, in terms of members of Congress speaking out and on and on and on. In members of the administration, members of the cabinet. So it's just never stopped. The only thing I think that prevented it from just closing out fairly fast is very unusual things happening both in American politics and foreign policy, which, hey, I've been around a long time. I spent a lot of the time in Washington. I've seen a lot of weird things happen, but this pretty much surpasses them. And in particular, as things really were getting close, the situation in Iran, that whole thing blows up. And it not only blows up, but it's escalating. It's getting very complicated. It is exactly the kind of thing you would expect to happen to lead into a third world war, whether it's nuclear or not.
Yeah.
And this is the irony. Well, it's not an irony, but this I have to point out.
Please.
For most of the last 30 years, I have, in terms of my activism, one of the threads that I'm constantly putting out there is that the presence of ETs is connected to the rise of atomic weapons, certainly the use in Japan, and of course the nuclear arms race that followed, and that there is a direct connection. And secondly, what has happened since Roswell, where we are now, two things are happening at the same time, which is interesting because all of the time I kept saying, year after year after year, disclosure is absolutely essential if we're to avoid a nuclear war. It's the only thing that could probably change course.
Yeah.
And guess what? I guess I was right. though being right is overrated, let me tell you.
It's not always the best.
Right
thing.
Now, everything we're seeing in the Gulf is exactly what you expect, prelude to a war. And at the same time, breaking things on the disclosure side in Washington are happening every couple of weeks. And so disclosure is coming, though it could, it could stop depending on what happens over in the war. And the war is coming, but it could stop, I hope, because what happens to disclosure. So we've got this kind of tension here. We need disclosure, I think, to avoid the nuclear war. We need the situation in Iran to settle down in order to get disclosure. It's kind of a catch 22 of sorts. And I didn't expect this. It's frustrating. It's driving me nuts. So with that in mind, the recent statement today, every day is a new statement in which it's not that the president is liberating people from their NDAs. I don't think it's just contractors. I believe it's any witnesses.
It's anybody. Anybody.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
In other words, David Grush would have been much safer position.
Yes.
There are many witnesses that are known that won't come forward because of NDAs and so forth. There are many witnesses we don't even know about that won't come forward because of these NDAs. And so this could create an avalanche of witnesses, though
it could.
It's going to take time for people to come to believe it. In other words, it's one thing to say you're exonerated or you don't face any penalties. It's another thing to really believe that. So that's going to take a little time. But this is a major breakthrough. At the same time, some of your viewers may or may not know this, but the fifth submission of the second half of the UAP Disclosure Act that was taken out when Schumer Rounds put it in the first time, all the way back in think it was 24. No, it was 20. Yeah, four. It's been put in again, and this time it has been put up for a vote. It has now a docket, a date on a docket for a vote, and this time it may pass. One can make a strong case given things that are happening in the White House and elsewhere. It's going to pass, and it includes the eminent domain clause that was taken out. It includes the independent review panel, and probably most of the other stuff. Meaning that after all these years, Mike Rounds and Senator Schumer are pretty much going to get the bill that they courageously put out way ahead of pretty much everyone else. You can find all the copies of the original bill. You can find the ones that were passed if you
Wow.
look in the right places online, and you can see how it was
Yeah.
shrunk down. And I'm think probably I'm certain you can find the submission that is going to be in the House docket. And this was championed major by Eric Burleson, who is a major leader on this issue.
Yeah.
There's no question. He is fierce. He is solid. He is committed. He is also very much in the Republican
Yep.
Party, and not in the Republican Party, but he's very much with the current president and with other things going on. And so he doesn't have that problem. And of course, Ana Paulina Luna, in her own way, has been incredibly fierce. She's got her own things going on. She's pressing. So you got
Yeah.
two of them pressing. And then you've got other members that are frequently speaking out, like Tim Burchett. It's relentless. It never stops.
Yeah.
And any reasonable person, even people who edit or editors of some of these major papers who are supposed to be reasonable, should look at that and go, that's all I need to set up an entire disclosure team in my paper, right, to take this on full bore. Not quite there yet. Not quite there, but it's only a matter of time. And so this is where we are right now.
Yeah.
It's and so what I'm focusing on, I don't have inside connections. I'm an outside guy. I watch what's going on as an activist and try to decide where to do or what to do. I'm not trying to get inside shoulder to shoulder with somebody writing legislation. I'm a boutique activist. Now, Danny Sheehan's group, New Paradigm Institute, that is a full-fledged activist organization,
Yeah.
right? Substantial funding and boards of directors and a long, long history because it's part of the Romero Institute. And so he's the guy you go to for some of the more deep stuff, but I'm also a communicator, and by and large, one of the biggest problems in this issue in the disclosure process is that it's difficult to communicate to people
It
and that
is.
they understand it, and they get very confused. And my job, I think, is to just make it basic, straightforward, not get out of hand, be clear, not be afraid to say what I absolutely think is the case at the time. So I'm kind of a populist advocate in
Yeah.
that sense. Nope, I don't have a PhD, don't have, 30-year career in defense intelligence or defense contractors. I'm just an activist
But I think
that does believe we need it.
that also lends you to a different realm of things, though. I mean, it lends you to a beautiful realm of trust, Stephen. The fact that you are independent, that you don't come from the realm of intelligentsia, that you don't come from the realm of being a science advisor to presidents or anything like
Well, there's
that,
no,
you
we don't
know.
want to pick on anybody, but I'm an outsider. I'm an outside
No,
activist.
that's what I'm saying. You are a
And
concerned citizen, truly.
the role of the outside activist, of which there have been many,
Yeah.
is to finally get the inside people to become activists in a sense.
That's
But
right.
it is much more difficult because in high-level people, give me an example. If you're a journalist, you have significant restraints on what you can do, what you can say, how you go about your business.
Yeah.
If you're a politician, you got all kinds of complicated limitations of what you
Yeah.
do, both legal and political. If you're in the military, say no more. I mean, you've got all these limitations and so
Yeah.
forth. If you're a academic, right, high-level academic with prestige and whatever, you have substantial limitations on what you can do. And I get that, and that's always been the case. And
Yeah.
those limitations have been harvested by the truth embargo managers for 80 years to as part of the process of keeping this thing under wraps. And this is where the activists come in, the kind that I am,
Yeah.
the street, activists in the anti-war movement, or the ones that, they were out doing the protests, whatever, the people's advocates. This is where we come in. Why? Because we have no constraints. None. And if you're truly an activist in the right way, You don't have a financial constraint, meaning you don't have to make money from it to do it, but it would be helpful. Okay. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so you're not going to say things in order that are really not in just not what needs to be said. You're deviating from the fundamental message and what needs to be done in order to bring in some money so you can do some more. This is not easy to do. And so we don't have any constraints. And thus we say what we want to say. Now, having said that, there's another kind of activist that is in a similar realm. And so this is like the bizarro world, right? You know, the flip, the upside down, all that kind of stuff. These are propagandists. These are activists who have no constraints on the truth. They will say whatever they say to get something, and it doesn't have to be true. And propagandists are basically activists, and a lot of them can be citizen activists. A lot of them are state operations. They're heavily funded. And so in the early years, the citizen activists, like the ones that went out to try to unionize countries, all of companies all over the country, and they had resistance certainly from the corporations and so forth, didn't like that, and there was obviously some pro union propaganda and pro business propaganda, but it's not like now. Now, if you want to be the citizen activist, you're up against massive, complex propaganda machines with huge amounts of money and access to virtually everybody on the planet. This makes this kind of activism a lot more difficult. And frankly, and there are other activists in other areas that would say the same thing.
Yeah,
I am very fortunate because I can think of a number of activist movements I couldn't touch. I mean, I just wouldn't go there. It's just too brutal. This one has a huge benefit. Because the issue transcends politics and religion and so many other things. It's just transcended. It's massive. It is very nonpartisan. So in terms of the country or the political party or your views, and to some degree even with religion, it is not partisan. And so in that sense, you can say what you mean. You can say what has to be said. And you generally, you know, because in other movements, when you do something like that, the side that is opposed to it comes after you, right? And there's always going to be the side that's opposed, and they can make your life miserable. But in this case, the side that opposes disclosure are simply people that are not ready to accept the fact that we are not alone, wherever they come from. My money's on the other stars. And that is uncomfortable for them. That's not the kind of thing that generates a massive blowback. But if you're a union activist trying to unionize some big companies, the people that own that company, they really don't like what you're doing. It's not trivial, and they will come and do terrible things to you. This is a movement that's about as safe as you can get.
Well, now,
and so I'm lucky that I picked it because I don't think I could have done it elsewhere.
Well, and you know. Honestly, once again, your work over the many, many decades to get to this point has been a mountain, Steve. It's absolutely amazing the fact that we are here. I'm 50 years old now, and the fact that we are having this conversation at this point is very fascinating to me and just so interesting. Because whether it comes from outside, whether it's our technology, whether it doesn't really matter. Once again, what the files and the releases show, what the numerous panels from the GOP Oversight Committee show, is that our government has been very, very interested in this over the last 60, 70 years and spent billions of dollars of our money doing it. And we have no answers.
And that's important. But, well, you said we don't have an answer. But understand,
the
government knew exactly what was going on 80 years ago.
Yeah.
And every year learn more and more and more. So they have had it all.
Yep.
Right. But in the citizen world, because we are a democratic republic, and there are other countries out there that are generally democratic, like Spain and France and the UK, and there's research that went on there. And oddly enough, in some of the more, how would you say, ideological control countries, they, you know, China, Russia, they actually didn't have a big problem with UFO research, again, because it transcends these things.
Yeah.
Okay. So, let me see if I get my message back here. The government all the governments of the world, many with no effort, and they're just not in it. They're just not in the game. It's okay. They don't want to be. They're outside. But of all the governments in the world that clearly have a stake in this issue, which is all the nuclear powers, all the major economies, any country that's got a significant arm, one, at least their head of state has been informed one way or another that, yeah, this is real. Now, what you do about it is another matter. Whether you can get any information is another matter. But do you know it's real? Yeah. It's useful to them to know that. And it's very not that difficult. People in great with great power and great money can get that information, the key information. Maybe not where the crash vehicles are housed, but the fact that there's non-human intelligence here, I think in post-disclosure, we're going to be startled at how many people knew, certainly at heads of state and some of our very wealthiest individuals. Hi, Leon. Hi, Elon. How you doing?
Yeah.
And so what we're doing is what we had to do as citizens, because initially there was no political basis at all. And so we did our own research. We did massive amounts of research. And the government, as long as we didn't press the government on the issue of the embargo, which I wasn't even called, truth embargo was a term I came up with around 2002, pushed it. I've never really, it's on my website, but I've never really written something where it kind of, you know.
I love that term, though. It's absolute truth. It really is.
I got credit for that one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Also, I came up with Disclosure Day in 2011. Actually, a couple of other fellows, but I promoted Disclosure Day in 2011. Yeah. Whatever. And so they tried to prove it. And God bless them. They felt that because, you know, the people, Americans back in the 50s and the 60s, by and large, certainly those eras and going forward, really still trusted their government and by and large. And they felt if we get the proof on this, the government will go, wow, thank you. We're going to look into this. And boy, it would all happen.
Yeah.
It took a while for them to realize they could approve this thing 20 times over. The government wasn't going to do squat.
Yep.
All right. But so they built up this massive amount of evidence, which I think most people are going, I got to see the next video from the DOD. When all of this stuff has been researched to death. There's hundreds of books they could go read right now that would tell them vastly more than what they're getting in this political
process
underway.
Yeah.
And I hope that those books end up in colleges and libraries and get taught in school, because they may not have had the academic prima mater, but they were well done and they're extraordinary.
Absolutely.
And then activism, journalism, we did it all. And still the truth embargo didn't end. What was needed was a clear activist movement. And that is what I saw when I decided to do this in 96. When I relocated back to Washington and I said, is there a true activist movement on this? And the answer was no, there wasn't. Activist step. Now, somebody that wants it to happen, somebody that's writing a letter to the newspaper, I get that. I'm talking about an activist movement. Now, the problem I had is that an activist movement is not a cheap thing to create, and I didn't have any money. And I knew that, and it wasn't going to be easy to get money. But I said, okay, I got a free place to stay, and I'm in Washington, so I'll just do things that will, in one way or another, advance an activist movement. And that's why I registered as the lobbyist, the first one, because there'd never been a lobbyist. And the message was, well, if there's a lobbyist, there must be something to this, right? And if there's a lobbyist, well, that means that the political people might be talked to. Well, I couldn't talk to them. They wouldn't talk to me, right? I mean, I could have really annoyed them and wandered the halls until eventually I became anathema.
Yeah.
And I wasn't going to do that, but I really hit the media hard. I mean, I just pounded the media on this issue. And I take some responsibility for the fact that since 1996, something like maybe 16,000-17,000 articles in mainstream publications about this issue have come out. Well, that I have archived, and probably another 15,000 or 20,000 that I didn't get access to or whatever. And so I did that, and then you create a website, and then you start talking about it politically. Now, Stephen Greer was doing something similar in the early 90s because he was dealing with government. They had reached out to him when they found out he was taking some pretty important people out for CE5s. And they're going, wait a minute, so-and-so was out there on a CE5? What the hell's going on here? And so, you know, I think they did the right thing rather than, you know, arrest him, you know, put him in jail. They brought him in. They said, you know, come talk. And so he got a lot of access. And so he's engaging in essentially the situation in D.C. And the 2001 press conference in May was somewhat political, no question, but it was also very much evidential. But he and a number of the witnesses went and toured the halls of the White House, and this was in the halls of Congress, rather, trying to have little chats. And this was 2001, so I don't think the members of Congress were rushing out in the hall to talk to them. But still, so he was an early activist, no
He
question,
was, absolutely.
and researcher and everything else, but not quite in the way that I had in mind. And that is, I don't burden myself with having to do research. I haven't got the money or the time. I've never had an experience, contact, seen anything ever, so I don't have any bias there. I'm not going to go in that direction. I'm just going to bug the media until eventually the Congress might start opening up a little bit and do conferences like the X Conference, which was in political activism in a way because it was in D.C. area, including one at
Absolutely.
the press club. The whole press conference was there. And then the citizen hearing on disclosure is the most political activist thing I did, with the help of several people. But it was my idea. I got the funding and did the citizen hearing on disclosure in May. Was it May 9th to June 3 or May June 29th, whatever. It was in 2013, and it was at the National Press Club main ballroom. It cost a lot of money. 42 witnesses, 10 countries, 6 members of Congress on the panel, and 30 hours of testimony. A DVD copy of all of that provided to every single office on the Hill, and some of them may be still sitting in a drawer somewhere. So that was kind of the peak of my activism, and it was all done leading up to the election that was coming, I had, and most people had a very strong feeling that Hillary Clinton was going to become the first woman president. And of course, she and her husband have a connection to this issue, along with John Podesta, all the way back to 93. Already articles have been written about it. And so my job, I saw, was to ensure that the last 14, 15 months of this campaign was not going to be E.T. poor, right? And over 400 articles, 400 articles were written in the last 16 months about the UAP issue, the vast majority of which referred to Secretary Clinton, and they're up on my website. And that was that. That to me was it. That was 19. That was 2000 and basically 15, 16, my 40th year. And I'm saying, this is it. This is it. Well, when it comes to major historical processes, and you're an activist, you really want to avoid getting to that this is it territory, because you're going to suffer if you do. And so when she lost the election, pretty much everything I had been working on for 20 years was flattened. Boom. And I went into a deep depression. Of course, I do have medications, thank God. And I had to leave the country. I was so upset. I left the country. I just didn't want to hear anything. I went to the UK, which I love, and London rather, and I'm writing the underground and meeting new friends. I did that for almost 8 months before I came back, and started over. But fortunately, I came back a few months after the To the Stars Academy came out and the New York Times articles were printed. And I realized, okay, the men that did this and led by Tom DeLonge had the guts, because they were going to do this when Clinton was president, maybe even during the transition, right? Trump was a whole different thing. And they had the guts to go forward anyway. They waited about 8 months. They came out, I think, in October. And off we go. And so now my job was to kind of start over and try to help that, get involved, whatever, just help advance things coinciding with that. Did I think it would take 10 more years? No, I did not. But the political situation in those 10 years really got problematic, difficult, taking up enormous amounts of political time and journalistic time, a political upheaval that like I've never seen. And I paid very close attention to the Nixon era and all that kind of stuff. And so it slowed it down. It slowed it down. And then, all right, it turned. And the reason it turned, which again, in 1,000 years, I could not have predicted this. The reason it turned is the president that won the election in 16 that meant that this issue basically just flatlined almost right away.
Yep.
Went on to have a term. The movement was kind of advancing a little bit. All right. And under the Biden administration, we had some of those hearings. So a lot of things were happening. All right. But the president wasn't getting involved. Biden wasn't going to touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Yep.
And then Donald Trump comes back as president. And in a totally different frame of mind, in a totally different way. And so when he comes back, it's Donald Trump unchained. And the result of that is that he, and to some degree his, you know, his immediate circle of administration and cabinet, they could give a crap about Truman's decision to start this embargo, or Eisenhower's decision to keep it, and all the other presidents that couldn't touch it. They could care less. They have other issues to deal with. So having a problem over that issue, they don't care. And so consequently, they got into it. And then the president got into it. And the president's cabinet got into it. And the president's family got into it. And that had never happened before. And I believe it's very much the result of the nature of the man, his philosophy, his worldview, what he's like, that made him it possible for him to do what other highly esteemed presidents wouldn't do. And that now has taken us right to the edge. Disclosure is on the doorstep. We just need to open a screen door, take the package in. And that's the best metaphor I've ever come up with. But and so I'll finish with this.
Please.
And I've said this many times, that people need to stop focusing on what you're going to get next, what video you're going to get next, or whatever. It's not about that. These things happening are happening and somewhat controlled in a way. I mean, they're not throwing the doors open, but what is happening is still within a certain range to do what? To inform you immediately of what's going on? No, obviously not. But to allow the process to go forward, where this legislation is passed, this committee is formed, that hearing is held, the president's, you know, son says this, the president does this, and what? And we're walking forward until the great political class and the great economic, you know, class, which, you know, rules as much of this country almost as the politicians, and to some degree the public, get to a point where they're going, okay, they can do this now.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
And when I say do this, I'm talking about the president coming out and disclose. If a member of cabinet comes out and says, yeah, we're not alone, that is not disclosure. It will create some news.
Yeah.
And it could create a serious political problem.
But it already has created news. They've already said the things I've seen would keep you up at night.
Well, no, but I'm saying if he actually came out and said, I know for a fact. Yeah. Because, you know, several people have said that.
No, sure.
I mean, Bush has kind of said that.
Yeah.
But he's not the Secretary of State.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, but ultimately, it has to be the president, unless the president confirms it and then follows it up with some directives. The ability to get it all, to bring and to stop the bullshit, the lies, the you know, the propaganda, the games, and, you know, any threats or whatever, to stop that, the president must disclose. And either he's going to be first, or he'll be second or third, depending, you know, if some other head of states end this embargo.
Yeah.
Which I would prefer my president did that, and your president did that.
Yeah.
I'm a president, and America, I think, would benefit if we end the embargo and then do it right.
Yeah.
And follow up correctly. But, you know, I mean, a case could be made. No, it might be better if the UK did it. So, but that's my operating.
As long as it's done, I'm happy.
Yeah,
you know, absolutely. And I have said for the longest time, there have been some very, very interesting disclosures with Donald Trump as president. We got the JFK files while he was president. And a lot of that is because, he is not somebody who has been mired in the halls of Congress for 20 years before he was elected. He didn't come from the world of political perch or something like that. You know, so it allows him to sidestep a lot of those things. And like you said, just kind of say, damn the torpedoes. Let's go do this. Because
the reason we got the JFK files now is because
they
in the initial
out.
Decades, enormous political implications.
Yeah. Yeah.
All kinds of problems.
Yep. Same thing
so
with
the
new.
It took this long.
Yeah. Same thing with the new MK Ultra. The new MK Ultra panel, same way.
The reason we haven't gotten the Epstein files is because that's recent.
Yep.
And it has enormous political implications.
Huge.
Now,
huge.
We've entered a time when we're starting to see transparency and honesty starting to be appreciated far more. The populist demand for truth documents in a timely fashion, definitely greater than it's ever been. And of course, with the internet and all the other tech that we have now, the ability for people to display their interest or irritation is now magnified way above. You know, 60 years ago, you're really upset. You wrote a letter to the paper and they probably didn't print it. Now you can go on your podcast and tell 100,000, 500,000 people.
Yeah.
So we may be about to enter an age where all of a sudden telling the truth, getting stuff out, being forthright, candid, and if there's a problem for you, you know, apologize profusely, ask for forgiveness, whatever. Yeah. This could be kind of what could come from this.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't want to get too carried away here. I just want disclosure.
Well, you know, it's interesting because as somebody, the one thing I tell my wife, all kinds of people, is that we are connected in a way that we have never been, not just as humanity, but as communities in this country. You know, when Roswell happened, the anniversary just passed of Roswell, when that happened, maybe you heard something on the radio, but those headlines didn't hit all across the country. People in Poughkeepsie didn't necessarily get that news in 1947. You know what I mean?
Oh, God, no. So, there were a lot of articles, but they were just in small town papers,
exactly,
little papers.
Exactly.
Not the big ones, really. I think maybe something New York Times, but overall, and it's over.
Now,
and the paper goes into the birdcage.
Yep.
That was 47. Now, that's why the truth embargo is going to be easy to start and easy to manage.
Exactly.
But the day the internet showed up and email showed up, websites, basically the truth embargo's days were numbered.
Yeah.
And then as you get broadcast radio online and you got the podcast, the idea that anybody at the DOD or in some defense contractor is sitting there going, you know, if we just hold out a little longer, they'll lose interest, or, you know, we can handle this. No, they can't. They're getting crucified and barbecued. And, you know, they're basically defense people. They're not bad people. But they're tied to this truth embargo historically, and they personally can't get out of it because the only way they get out of it is if the president of the United States ends it.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting because amongst all of those things, and I'm bringing the article up right now, all of this started from the Leslie Keene Blumenthal article, you know, the big article in New York Times.
Era, the
absolutely,
beginning,
this era.
That article. Plus the To the Stars Academy.
Absolutely.
The people that came out with it.
They were concurrent.
Started engaging the government.
Yeah. And right along that was Lou Elizondo. I think it was like December 23rd, 2017, went on CNN with the famous clips. All those things happened pretty well concurrently. But this article came out probably about a year or so ago. There it is. June 6, 2025. So right at a year ago. Pentagon disinformation that fueled America's UFO mythology. Like, these are the things I talk about regularly. We're like, they used us and the communities and social, like, they got rid of the PSYOP officer that comes up with the cover programs for Black Budget. They were like, why would we do that? They're writing the stories for us. Just follow them on social media and we'll use that as cover.
Yeah, let me provide some context.
Please.
It, there's going to be the odd story like the Wall Street Journal.
Oh, sure.
And I'm talking about major papers, but not many. Very, very few. Okay. For whatever reason, as we know, there's been pushback, right? Yep. There's a number of ways that those operating behind the curtain have been able to push back, like the lobbyists that came in and gutted the UAP disclosure bill. Their names weren't published, but we knew pretty much that that's what was going on. There's going to be some of that. And this is another example. Now, why it happened, I don't know. All I know is that a reporter, two reporters, were given a story.
Yep.
Now, no one has bothered to, how would you say, dig into this to find out Did the Wall Street Journal reach out to the DOD and say, "Hey, we'd like to do a story of what's going on," or did the DOD reach out to the Wall Street Journal and say, "Yeah, we've got some information, might
We
make a
got a
nice
story
story.
for you.
Send a couple of reporters." I don't know. But the lead reporter on that interviewed me for 40 minutes, and I was cool and everything, and I didn't say anything. And it's only now that I'm mentioning this, but it's not trying to be a nasty guy. I deeply suspected what was going on. The questions I was being asked, the reactions were not what you expect. I'm not a major
Interesting.
witness,
Interesting.
the major witness they were after was Robert Salas,
Oh, wow.
right? But I was
Wow.
connected to Robert Salas. One of the reasons he got in touch with me is he wanted to get, and whatever. And so he gave me an interview. And I'm going, I didn't like it. Okay. So the story comes out. Now, is it a grotesque embarrassment to the Wall Street Journal? Absolutely. Is it a noble attempt by the DOD possibly to slow this thing down? Yeah, right. It's like running out in front of a bus and saying, "Stop," right? I mean, no, just leave, hold it, and stop as the bus is like 5 feet away. So no good. It was embarrassing. Again, one of the reasons the truth embargo is failing is that it's so grotesque now and so beyond its shelf life that any effort to try to do something blows up in their face. It's like the whole gutting of the UAP Act was everybody found out about it. It was all kinds of news. And so, and everybody was pissed off at the defense contractors and Lockheed and all that stuff. It was not much of a win. And this one, okay, in order to debunk some of the stuff that's coming in, the Pentagon made the decision to out either create a non-existence or out a kind of a program, or at least a certain things that went on, because they were having fun with pilots by telling them about stuff and giving them, there's this or that, or there's saucers, in order to just so that they might spread that information, whatever the hell. And it was almost a prank. And I'm going, are you kidding me? If this is true, it's outrageous. And if it's not true, it's doubly outrageous. And so if I'm a pilot, if I was a pilot that was actually victimized by that, they gave me some bullshit so I could be sort of an unwitting agent, I would be angry. But what can you do, right? Nothing you can do. And then, but that was just the opening thing was just ridiculous. Nobody got in with that. But then they got into what that article was about. I believe that that first part of the article was to minimize the sense that what the article was absolutely going at, the reason for it, is the Pentagon. Let me state this as emphatically as I can.
Please.
The number one thing every national security official, officer, manager, right up into, secretary offices, are afraid of in terms of hearings is the nuclear weapons tampering hearings. They've been waiting them out for 34 years since that came out, right? But basically, since 1964 5. So we're talking 60 years, hoping they would all just die. And a lot of them did. The officers, there's only a couple left. And Robert Salas is one of them. And Robert Salas has been an activist on this issue, a one issue activist, which is those shutdowns and being able to testify on them. He's been 33 years at it. There's almost nothing he hasn't done. And the fact that he and several of these other witnesses might testify in front of Congress, these are silo commanders. We're not talking David Grush here. We're talking silo commanders. These are members of the Air Force, so solid after being carefully reviewed and studied and worked with, they're prepared to put them in the bottom of that silo. And if the two of them turn the key at the same time, the world comes to a rather
Abrupt.
unpleasant face. So it's not like you're picking these people random, right? Or given some, I know, kind of a weird kind of guy, officer there, give him a second chance. No. And so those people would be profound witnesses. And so they have just ghosted them. So what they've done is they don't make an effort to go after them. They didn't. They don't try to undermine him really, though I think Bob had some issues early on. But they think if they just don't say anything, that somehow they'll never turn up in front of a committee. And even though there have been plenty of articles written about it and a major book by Robert Hastings about it, UFOs and Nukes, and a documentary about it, they've managed to get to this day, 62 and 3 years after the two best known shutdown events at Maelstrom and Minot, but with other evidence confirming other shutdown events, including the Soviet Union, they managed to get where it still is not in front of a hearing. Now, Bob has been one of my major projects. I've done everything I can. I submitted all of the legal statements. What do you call them? I forget what you call them. Anyway, these are
The affidavits.
affidavits and statements from eight or nine nuclear witnesses. Every single member of the Intelligence Committee of the House Oversight Committee, and the House and the Senate Intelligence Committee, sent them in, handed it out. What can you do? I've done some emailing and so forth. I also worked. Tyler Robinson helped me get, or I helped Tyler Robinson get Bob Salas with a meeting with Nancy Mace. She was impressed. I did had some help in getting a meeting for Bob Salas in front of Eric Burleson, who gave him a full out, wonderful meeting, fully filmed. You could find it online. Bob was very meticulous, a little slow describing it, but that's another thing that Eric has done. So much that I think history is going to be very, very generous with him. So, but still, but those things were happening. He's on the Hill. He's meeting with Macy. He's meeting with Burleson. I'm spreading all this stuff to these committees. And so somebody in the Pentagon said, we got to do something, or they're going to, you could, make them disappear like McCaslin. That's another interesting story.
Oh my
I have
God,
no idea
yeah.
what's going on there, but I'll tell you. Of all the people that they're putting out there is like, oh, they did something to him. I have no idea about them. But McCaslin, they're going to get to the bottom of that. I got a feeling if they ever do, there's going to be a lot of serious outcomes to that. In any event, so what they did is that they decided we're going to, and I think they approached the Wall Street Journal. And so the second half of the article was designed specifically to undermine Bob Salas. He wrote a very strong letter back to the Wall Street, who of course didn't publish it, but his paper Ojai did, and undermine him. And at the same time, undermine the whole idea of that these nuclear weapons were shot down by Kraft over the thing by putting forward, again, I think back to, Colonel Haynes when he came out in 97, because the Roswell thing was really exploding, and they had done the Mogul balloon thing, and they thought they had it under control, and the bodies started coming into play, and they were having to deal with that. And so they held this press conference, a big press conference over at the Pentagon with about 70, 80 journalists, and tried to bring down the body issue by stating that what people said they saw were not 4 foot gray entities.
Yeah, they were
They
test
were
dummies.
5, 6 foot crash test dummies in Air Force uniforms 5 years later. And when asked by a reporter, how is that? They said, well, we call it time compression. I mean, this would make a sitcom. I mean, this is funny. This is almost at that level. So they're saying that what was going on is the government built a huge apparatus in order to test whether these missiles could be affected by outside intrusion, right? Because they have very substantial systems, and that these things were kind of off to the side or something, and and nobody knew about it. And the guys that were the security guys mistook it for a craft overhead, and this was published. Now, if I'm the Wall Street Journal, well, they have to they have to maintain ties to the Department of Defense. Obviously, that's where they get stories. But man, if I was a Wall Street Journal, I'd get a couple of those DOD guys at least privately, and just roast them. Say, this is not going anywhere. This is between us and you, and roast them, because this is an offense to every
Well,
American, an
it's
offense to our government, an offense to our policy. So that was recent. Now, there hasn't been one like that since. There's been a couple of debunkers who were putting out the odd article here, but nothing since. It's coming into the mainstream media that even remotely looks like some stupid effort to support sub undermine this process. So that's good. And I don't expect any more. I mean, I pity the poor paper, a major paper, that
Absolutely.
decides, let's give it one more shot. We will explain Roswell all over again
But they
from a
say
wholly
they,
different angle. Okay, based upon documents we found in the basement of one of our reporters whose father worked in the Air Force in the 40s, whatever the hell. Let's hope they don't do that.
Well, and that's just it. Like you're saying, to see that what would be pretty close to obvious propaganda by the government, when you are taking cover stories and pushing them out to the public for things like that, there's no other definition to that other than propaganda being disseminated to the American
Well,
public.
it's more than just propaganda. I mean, propaganda is to change people's minds and so forth, so that they think a little differently and they're less
Well,
difficult to work with. This is a definite intervention, all right? It's more than just propaganda. It's a specific intervention to try to stop something from happening. So it's like calling somebody up and threatening to kill them if they testify before Congress. That the statement threatening to kill, we will kill you, is not propaganda. And that's kind of what that is. They're trying to intercede. Now, it's not that bad,
Well,
but
publicly muscle
it's
him
in
without
almost too
anybody
blatant to be
knowing.
propaganda.
And when you look at things like that, when you look at these issues, because it was brought up not only in the whistleblower testimonies, but also in a separate hearing all about drones that Lou Elizondo was in. I remember we had to emergency record an update to an episode that we had recorded with someone about the drones because there was a whole, I was during the episode record, I was like, guaranteed after all of this, within 2 or 3 days, there will be an emergency hearing about funding for drones. And sure enough, there was. And it was Lou Elizondo. And they asked him, why aren't we having a bigger conversation? And he said, because that would belie the fact that we have gaping holes over our nuclear facilities and other sensitive sites. And oddly enough, right after that, what did we see?
Well,
Drones all
not
over
necessarily
sensitive
gaping
sites.
holes. Well, okay, you're right. Well, let me do this way. Most of the drones are seen over civilian areas. There were some that got over some bases. But let me sum up that in a few words. Now, this is opinion of mine, which is purely an opinion.
Same.
I can't prove it, but boy, I got a real strong feeling about it. And that is this. That whole thing was about the fact that one of the ways extraterrestrials, as I believe they are able to move around or remotely or in person, okay, is they have their own drones. Only they're not like our drones. They are orbs. They are some kind of manipulated, highly complex or manipulatable plasma effects. And these orbs can go anywhere they want, do anything you want. You can't shoot them down. And that's been going on for a long time, all the way back to the Foo Fighters in World War II, where these orbs, these plasma orbs, were following planes around, not hurting them, right? And there were pilots reporting them all the time. But what are you going to do? Start researching that? You're actually in the middle of a world war. It's been on forever. Okay. And so how does the government deal with that? And when a significant flap of orbs, again, I'm not talking about craft. They turn up here and there and whatever, and there have been some craft flaps, but this is an orb flap. And so I think the government did the only thing they could do is start launching human orbs up into this stuff, right? And then so you could say, yeah, well, that's an orb. Screw that. Here's a drone, right? And just kind of dilute the thing. And that's what this is all about. And so I really don't give a damn about any drones flying over a base, other than they should shoot them down, right? If it's a security facility. Hell, if you fly a drone near an airport, you can go to jail for a couple of years. One just nearly hit
That's
a
right.
plane.
That's
But
right.
I don't care about that. I care about the plasma orbs that were filmed by thousands of people with their wonderful cameras as they moved all across the country for like 8 months. And that film is in their cameras right now. If the government wanted to, they could request that all of their orb films be sent to them so they could, amalgamate it and see how powerful it is. But they're not going to do that. And the people have it, they show them off. But let me tell you, when the orb flap occurred, this wasn't 1953 or four. This was 2000, and I don't know what the hell it was, 20, 23, I forget what the hell it was.
Yeah.
And 98% of the people in the country had high quality cameras in their hands all the time, right? In the old days, it was like something would happen and there'd be a camera in the trunk of the car and you wouldn't even
Yeah.
go to the trunk of the car for whatever reason. Now it's right in your hand. They're filming everything. And I'm going, but in the embargo people are going, that's okay. It's okay. Yeah, there's millions of cameras out there that can film anything. But I don't, just say it's fuzzy or deny it. And I just laugh. So that's kind of what that was all about. So don't focus on the drones. Believe me, drones are a
No,
big
that's
deal.
just it. Utterly distraction story. Utterly
Yeah.
distraction story from the topic at hand. Because that was happening in between two different whistleblower testimonies. It
Oh,
happened
yeah.
like within, like there was like a 3 week gap between the first two hearings, and it was during
And
that.
if you
So.
ask me why was there this huge drone orb thing? It went on for so many months that kind of started out in the Pacific where they were flying around,
Yeah.
ships, right? And not being shot down. Why weren't those guns blasting away? Because one way or another, the captain of that ship was informed, don't bother. You can't do it. And so, and it moves. How? Why did that happen? And I have this, a hunch that the ETs are not neutral parties in this disclosure process. They've never been neutral parties in this disclosure process. If they didn't want their presence to be known, the last thing you're going to do is fly over a nuclear missile base and turn off all the weapons, turn off all the missiles. I mean, that's going to attract a lot of attention
A little bit.
unless government really works to keep. So I think they've never been neutral on this. And I think things were kind of moving forward, but getting stalled and, kind of not going. And I think that whole plasma orb flap thing was just a way to goose the process. I could be wrong. One day I hope to ask and find out.
Well, and the whole goosing of the process to begin with, I think is hugely
That phrase dated me.
it's hugely important though. Hugely important because once again it's the fact of if we take this conversation back here in the last couple minutes to the idea that even now, even in this modern day and age with all the shows, with everything else, we are looking at a good just under 50% of the American populace. Like whenever you look at polls, a good 60% of people say, yeah, aliens exist. But there's still a large population that this is not, even amongst those people, this is not a point of conversation.
But that doesn't matter. That does not matter. Look, back in the early 20th century, the vast majority, 99% of the people in the world didn't know what the hell quantum physics or quantum mechanics was. So the idea was, well, we can't go there. We don't want to talk about that. Let's don't get out there. No, this kind of stuff at this level of history and so forth, is not a democratic process, right? And so the fact that maybe 50% of the people are still clueless, I don't, that doesn't bother me in the slightest. They will learn soon
Oh
enough,
no,
but they're.
that's what this is a setup for them to onboard to the conversation. Because like you're saying, we can't just rip the Band-Aid off. This is something that political processes have to take place. There's all kinds of things that we have to peel back layers of an onion to get to the sweet inside.
Well, yeah, but we've already done that. In other words, it's the Band-Aid needs to come off, right? I mean, it's been 80 years, so it's not like, we've been, just ripped the thing off. We've been slowly peeling it off for the last 80 years, and now it needs to come off. And as I said, one of the this whole thing about most people don't get the issue. So what? But it was used all the time in by the truth embargo people. Most of the people don't even believe this. Why are you wasting your time? It's not useful. It's not productive. Blah 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 blah. And again, I never bought into any of that because I didn't have to. Again, I'm an independent activist. I don't have to buy into anything I don't want to buy into.
Well, and properly good for you because that is how you once again stay on the road of truth. That is how you keep yourself away from the fact of being beholden to somebody else or to somebody else's money in that kind of way. There are a lot of ways that really good missions can be usurped in these communities. So good on you for keeping things proper and pure. I mean, a whole point of this show, Stephen, is the fact of in this community, in numerous adjunct communities, there are plenty of people digging rabbit holes around the pond and kicking dirt up.
Yeah.
We've got to drink from that pond eventually. So some of us have to start filtering that water. You know what I mean? So the idea of demystifying these things, the idea of having literally just candid conversations with people like you who have been entrenched in this for 30 plus years, is massively important. Massively important.
One more thing,
please.
I know
please.
I'm almost done.
Whatever time done. You need, you take.
Oh, don't you have somebody else coming on in a second hour?
That is a pre-record guest. My second guest is always pre-recorded, okay. So if the conversation's good, nobody's waiting in the chute.
We can continue.
Please.
I want to say this for those that perhaps too easily hate the government.
Yeah.
And I overlook so much of the important good stuff that the government makes for us. But again, does bad stuff, and they're mostly carrying around. Hey, what do you think? I hate the GAN thing. But didn't they do this last week? Yeah, that was okay, but I hate it. Look, I mean, it's 30 years. I had never been bothered, harassed, or anything. I think my phone was tapped for a while back around, I don't know, 99, 98. I got a telephone bill that was very strange. But I've never been asked, threatened, or anything else. I've never been asked in any way to put out a narrative that wasn't something that I was, you know, into and manipulated. I just never have. Now, it may be that I'm just not that important. I'm not a big deal. I'm a small thing. I'm a boutique activist. But I think what that says is I think ultimately the consensus in the government is the people need to learn, get this.
Yeah.
But they have a number of reasons why they felt it was not good. And then later on, it became a bit of a problem because after so many years of the truth embargo, obviously, it was going to be a bit embarrassing, right, for many people,
yeah,
and so forth. And I ultimately, I think that is where most of the government is. I do not think it is because the ETs are threatening to blow us all up if they do it. I don't think that is a factor. I don't think there's some super dark. And I used to have this conversation with Bell. We'd have the awful truth conversation. He'd bring up some awful truth that somebody had told him, right? This is what's going on. And then I would try to debunk this awful truth.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't think there is this awful truth there. I never have. And it almost doesn't matter now. If there's an awful truth, we're about to learn it. What I've always said is if there was an awful truth, I don't think anybody could make the case to me why 8 billion people who are independent entities with what some people believe souls and so forth, facing something awful, could be deliberately kept in the dark about it by their leaders who they're paying.
Yeah.
Right. And depending upon the nature of the awfulness, are in a position to know, well, I kind of know about this awfulness. And I think I'm going to build a giant bunker under my house in New Zealand, right? Unfortunately, you all don't know. So you can, whatever. That it justified. If something awful is coming, all 8 billion people should know. I think it's a fundamental, a matter of natural law.
Yeah.
And now, if some of them choose to go nuts, act out, go crazy, get depressed, I understand that. But, you know, we're all going to die.
Yeah.
Right. And so the idea of being kept in, you know, treated this way because, well, it looks like you're going to die sooner than you thought because we know something connected to this issue. Blah, blah, blah. That's why we can't tell you. Well, the whole thing is leaking out anyway.
Yeah.
And so it's a bad look for the human race. It's, I think, an insult to the integrity of the human race. And so no one has ever convinced me that there is anything that would justify this embargo. Now, in the early days, nuclear war risk.
Yeah.
But eventually that became no longer relevant because we're going to have the war unless we do this. Actually.
Well, and, you know, that's interesting because the last whistleblower panel that happened, George Knapp was a part of. Number one, I loved the fact that, A, there was an actual sitting master sergeant or master chief from the Navy,
sure.
Like still active duty. That was allowed to come and talk. Mm-hmm. That was pretty incredible. But the one I keep referring back to is George Knapp, because his specific statement was regarding the contractors. He was like, God bless the contractors. They have done their job. They've done the job that they were contracted by the government to do, to take these materials, research them, hide them, and tell nobody about them. But after 60, 70 years, 80 years of these materials being locked away in Bass, Bigelow, wherever they are. You got to be looking for some kind of onboarding for other people, because when it comes to scientific research, when it comes to this, that cannot happen in a vacuum, and it can only happen in a compartmentalized way so long. We got good stealth technology because of competition for the Have Blue program. We got robots on Mars with the speed that we did because of healthy scientific competition. The only way to make this stuff work for humanity in that kind of way is to open it up so that these contractors can talk with each other, research together, things like that. So,
well, that argument about the fact that open tech, even extremely profound tech,
yeah,
will develop faster is relatively new. I don't recall hearing that 30 years ago. But this is kind of new, and it shows a candidness, which is important. But put yourself in the shoes of the defense contractors.
Absolutely.
They got a super secret project. You're getting paid lots of money. You know, where it comes
real
from,
good money.
They're getting paid lots of money.
Real good
and
money.
Of course, they're developing proprietary technological and scientific knowledge of enormous value, which if they could have monetized it, say, maybe 20 years ago, they might have made a trillion by now. But nevertheless, it's not a bad situation. And so, and I think particularly the potential downstream earnings that they could come from any proprietary positions they had in ET-related technology was enough for them to go like that, not yet, and to try to gut that bill. So I kind of understand them. Remember, they serve their shareholders, and they're a contractor to the country. And so I don't expect Lockheed Martin to end the truth embargo. Not that they could.
Yeah,
it's up to the president to do it. But the person up there at almost the level of the president, which was the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, Schumer, Gang of Eight, highest clearance.
Yep.
He and Rounds created the bill and put eminent domain in there. Basically, what they were saying, you know, we need to move forward, and it's time to transition out of this split arrangement, which was done to maximize security and whatever the hell.
Yeah.
Get the resources of their engineers and scientists. We need to transition out, and he puts that in there, and they reacted almost immediately. And what irritated me about that, and it never came up. It wasn't coming up with the articles weren't writing about it. It was never in any article about this whole eminent domain clash that led to the gutting of that bill.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people don't understand eminent domain. I think most do. And when the government takes eminent domain, now, whether it's different when you're talking about national security classified tech, I don't know. But I'm just going to say the basic concept of eminent domain is the government must give fair value for it.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, fair value could be, okay, you're going to give this to us, and we are going to control what happens. When eminent domain takes a portion of somebody's land because a highway has to be built, what they're doing is saying, we are going to pay you fair value for this land because we are now going to decide how it's used. And so that ultimately was what was that bill was about. Schumer was saying the government needs to be making the decision going forward on this science and technology, not you, right? Because, well, we're the government representing the entire country and interfacing with the rest of the world. You're just some high-tech companies. And almost certainly, once eminent domain was instituted, and this stuff was now, how would you say, that connection was broken, and now the government controls it. That doesn't mean the tech is moved out of their facilities. I mean, we control it. The government then decides, and probably is going to decide, okay, we want to do research here, we want to do research there, and you do that, and we'll pay you, okay?
Yeah.
And that payment and that money and that revenue increases your shareholder value. And that is not unreasonable at all. But that was never brought up. It was like, you know, we're taking the tech away from them, and they did all the work and blah, blah, blah. And it's, you know, eminent domain is well known. That irritated me, okay? But I think some of these chairmen of the boards of these companies, it wasn't just about making more money from doing more research. They tried to imagine, or they had some dreams, what would the equity value be?
Oh, absolutely.
Of a priority position or a an actual majority position in anti-gravitic, say. In other words, you have the rights to it, right? Okay. Or the rights to something you made from it. So that is yours. And you start putting the price to that. And the next thing you know, the company's worth $3 trillion. I think they couldn't let go of that. And their job is to serve the shareholders
Absolutely.
first, believe it or not, and then the public's interest second. Though there are laws to regulate that, but those laws seem to be not going away as opposed to whatever. And so that was that episode. But they're not evil, and they'll end up being involved after disclosure, and they'll end up making money, and they'll help as this tech, as you say, gets shared. They will speed up rapidly the technological outcomes of this, and there are a number of technologies we have got to get from
That's just
this
it.
ET tech
And
in order to solve a number of problems right now that are threatening the entire civilization.
that is quite literally what I have been saying for the last many years, is that if you want a reason for this stuff happening, it is because, like, there is only so long that this tech can sit on the shelves and not be making money and not have a return on investment. There's got to be an ROI at some point for billions of dollars of investment, whether it becomes a weapon for the military, what have you. There's got to be some sort of ROI for the billions of dollars of investment in this research.
Let me give you a simple example of how you can break this down. When some people think of anti-gravitics, they think I can get from New York to London in 4 minutes, maybe instantaneously, whatever. That's unbelievable. That's unbelievable. Think of the business in this, and you can travel the world. Here's how I think of anti-gravitics. There's been a very big article published just yesterday on this. You can easily do some Google searches and find your AI searches. We have completely polluted near Earth and even a second level Earth. Unbelievable. I think it's 12, 15,000 active satellites. I don't know how many more that are inactive, 15, 18,000. There are hundreds of thousands of pieces of this size and that size. And in terms of just general debris, it's in the millions. The entire outer sphere, outside of atmosphere, is a giant junkyard. And there is a concept called the Kelser phenomenon, right? Or Kelser syndrome. It's been represented in one major movie called Gravity. It's turned up in a couple of others, a little overdramatic in Gravity, but it's simply this. If a significant enough thing blows up, or an impact creates an even bigger impact, and enough stuff is scattered, there's not enough time to start repositioning a lot of the stuff up there in order to avoid it. Do you know that the what is it? The space lab,
Yeah, the space
right?
station.
In the space, the space station up there. In 1 half-year period, they had to reposition it 50,000 times in order to avoid the junk. And so that stuff is going to scatter, and it's going to be a catastrophe. Okay, now you're going to have a much, you, in other words, you may not be able to fly to the moon anymore. I mean, there's no way you're going to get through it. I mean, you can't hit something that's traveling 17,000 miles an hour, even if it's the size of a quarter, and not something bad happening. And so we're going to have to make the damn, spacecraft out of cement. And so here is what, when I see anti-gravitics, and I've talked about this for a number of years. I don't do that slideshow anymore, but I'm bringing it back. Never heard a single person talk about this or write an article about it. The only way you're going to be able to clean up space around our planet, which we've polluted up in ways that even surpasses some of the garbage dumps in the South Pacific Islands. I'm telling you, some of those are 15 stories high, is we need an anti-gravitic craft that can operate in space independent of gravity, which means is it can stand still, right? Move whatever. All right. And so you take a bunch of these specially designed craft and you put them above, right? Above pretty much all of the space debris, and they start working their way down and literally collecting it. Huge amounts of it. It's not a hard concept. It's pretty simple. There's a lot of ways that they can bring that in and slowly clean up the debris all the way down to the bottom of near Earth
Well,
orbits, obviously avoiding satellites.
and of course, if you have any gravitic technology, you don't have all the blast material from stages of rockets,
Well, yeah, no,
things
I mean,
like
that's
that.
true too, but
You know,
that's a simple problem, right? You don't have that.
yeah,
But I mean,
yeah,
the
you,
billion, the hundreds of millions, the millions and millions of
yeah,
pieces up there have got to be cleaned up.
absolutely,
That will do that.
it
And
will.
so somebody could say to the government, well, that would be a good thing. It would be great. Well, but we don't have any gravitics. We don't think it's possible, you know, and that's where I start to disseparate. You know, it's like, please.
Yeah.
Right, get another job. I don't know. Retire. You've made good money. You got a nice pension. Get out of here. Right. So that is one example of an extraordinary use of that tech. Right. The way they can maneuver. If we can even come close to that, we can design a craft that will actually allow to gather up the space debris
Yeah.
until it's all gone. And I can go on. I can. There's four or five others. I think I'll go on,
Well,
but. These are the things that I talk about, and nobody talks
absolutely.
about this. They talk in general mostly about, well, energy prices will go down.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. If we have an energy breakthrough, that's a
Yeah.
big deal.
Yeah,
Okay.
we get into the point of like any gravitic turbines for power generation, sure. You know, something like
Yeah,
that
yeah.
where it's a
Well, that's another
frictionless motor
example.
now. So, you could almost have eternal power at that point, and the whole concept of perpetual motion. But it would take any gravitic technology. It would take something like that to do
I
that.
can't imagine any other way they can do it.
Yeah.
What are they going to fly put a satellite up there, and as they're cruising around,
Yeah.
they put out a little extension and grab a piece, right, bring it back in. I mean, with anti-gravitics, you could build huge craft.
Yeah.
They could be substantial. They could be a half a mile across, and
Exactly.
they're out there in the outer system, and they're coming back in and just gathering stuff up like crazy, avoiding any active satellites, of course. And pretty soon we have a clear sky, and there's no you have to worry about running into anything.
Yeah.
We're going to lose astronauts. We're going to lose space stations. People are going to die. And anybody that reads that article and asks themselves, how in the hell did we pollute all of nearer space? I mean, we do pollute. I mean, we're constantly creating, dumps and dumps and this and
Yeah.
that. And we pollute a lot. We're polluting a significant amount of Pacific Ocean. But all of space? I mean, that's a level of irresponsibility and stupidity that I think the human race
It
would
is
be incredibly
abounding,
we should
isn't
be
it?
embarrassed about.
It is an
I
abounding
think we
level
won't
of
pollute.
stupidity.
We will pollute the moon if given the opportunity.
Absolutely.
There's already some discussion about how we don't want to do that. But don't be shocked.
I have jokingly said on this show and the previous show for years, Stephen, that no, we definitely went to the moon. We were just gladly invited not to come back. just please, guys, we'll look at you from over there, all right?
Yeah.
And you know, it's the whole idea of if aliens did come, would we be the planet that they lock the door as they go by, like the Griswold family? You know,
Yeah.
where the example I give is, I'm trying to remember the name of the movie. I want to say it might have been Mac and Me, where quite literally, it's a kid who these aliens come to, but the whole time before the aliens get here, the only thing they've been exposed to is TV and radio with zero frame of reference. So they actively talk like television and do like, you know, Lucy and Ricky skits on their ship and things like that. And it's hilarious because it's a concept whenever you think about it. Like, yeah, if they're coming interstellarly, first thing they're going to start seeing with zero reference is our transmissions and the things that we put out. And that's horrifying. If you get all of that without the actual frame of
Oh, I
reference of
see where
what
you're
was
going
happening
here.
in the world,
Well,
like,
no,
who are
I
these
look.
people? My God, I don't want to go where that's coming from.
I tell you what they do. I think the ETs, if they're hanging out in the, certain solar system somewhere, checking in, I think they go to IMDb. I think you go to IMDb and you check the ratings, and you only look at like, 7, 5 plus. Yeah, same thing
Yeah,
with the
yeah.
movies on YouTube.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't watch the crap. You watch the good stuff.
That's
I mean,
right.
I'm staying with some friends. They have a TV. It's got everything on it you can imagine. It's got Tubi and
Yeah.
and Truth. I mean, YouTube and Tubi and Sling and then all the other stuff.
Yeah.
It's massive. There must be thousands of videos that I can access right through that screen
Yep.
with the remote. Okay. Which is changing our world in a very dramatic
It
way,
is.
probably not for the better. All right. And so the fact is the ETs have got an enormous range of stuff to watch. And I think they're going to watch the great stuff. And they're going to tell the other ETs, yeah, this is good, that's good. And they're not going to spend much time watching the nonsense.
Yeah.
Now that stuff will follow us down through history because most of it's now in electronic storage.
Yep.
And so some of the worst sitcoms of all time will actually be turning up probably in the year 3002. But whatever. Who know? We may transcend that.
Thank God we have all
But
those terabytes selected for Love Island, right?
and by the way, the truth embargo has generated a lot of humor.
Oh,
I've got like,
absolutely.
I don't know, 150 cartoons on my computer right now that I've gathered over the years that reflects a lot of humor. But probably, I don't know if it's the best, but one of the one I like the most is, which perfectly encapsulates this, is that you've got some SETI scientists rather, with a telescope and they're looking up, for the ET stuff, right? Very seriously. They got the glasses, they got the lab coats, and there's a book underneath that says SETI or whatever. And about 15 yards behind him, there's an extraterrestrial grade pissing against a tree. That says it all, my
Yeah,
friend.
yeah.
That says it all. Now,
No.
that, it wasn't accurate because we're pretty sure the grays don't piss, but the point is he got the point across, right? And I have issues with SETI, and we don't need to go there. But nevertheless, the truth embargo is so absurd, and because we live in a still a basically free country with freedom of speech, still now, I mean, really, we've got plenty of freedom of speech. It's just a little tinged.
Yeah.
We can make fun of all that,
We can.
and we do, and ultimately, that's the benefit of everyone.
Well,
So I don't. Look, they're going to do their thing. We're going to do our thing.
yeah.
And as long as the truth wins out eventually, I don't think we have too much to complain about, given that the nature of history has been lots of propaganda and lies, massive wars of empire, destruction of entire cities.
Yeah.
That's been going on for a long time. And so I think we're still making progress here.
Well, I think we're making huge progress, Stephen. And like I said earlier, it's the fact of we've got to onboard people to this conversation in a larger way, and this is how we do it. It may not be as quick as a lot of people like it, but whatever it takes to get everybody on board into the conversation, I am all about. And I'm ecstatic as to where we're at now, because at least in my lifetime, this is more than we've ever had before.
Well, there's a number of things that have come together that really is helpful for the disclosure happening at this time,
Please.
as opposed to 55, 65, 75. And one of them is the mass media access and podcasts, particularly podcasts, which is going to eventually replace, I think, most of a lot of other media. So, and the fact that everybody has access to them. If you got a computer and you got Starlink, you could be in the middle of the Amazon, forest. You're watching,
Yeah.
some podcast. So when disclosure takes place, the ability for hundreds of billions of people to go in and hear people talk about it, hear them being questioned about it, not just 15 minutes of news on ABC, but rather, lengthy discussions of all kinds, which is already happening. But then, God knows how many more
Yeah.
UFO ET related podcasts will happen after disclosure. But put a number at 2,000. And so the world is going to have immediate broad access to this event and what's behind it and what's going on, which is exactly what you want. Wouldn't have been the case in 1955. That's for damn sure.
Yeah.
All right, people would have been learning about it months later. People wouldn't understand it
If at
initially,
all.
and it's not getting weird. So that's good. Okay, we also have enough huge knowledge of science and the universe. We have a telescope out there that's actually seeing almost to the edge of the universe, but 13.8 billion years. However, there's some re recent findings, from the that telescope that there's some things turning up that are not supposed to be there, right? It's like, wait a minute, that seems like it's not supposed to be there. Like it's, and so, but we are learning this, we're seeing this, we're even getting photos. So that's good. That's what you would like to have when you're going to have disclosure. All right. I think we could have got made it through disclosure in 47 if Truman had done it. It would have been different. But in terms of maximum engagement, maximum what we'll call normalization, there's no question that now is optimal. And the lead up to disclosure, you know, the slow roll, the drip, all that kind of stuff, do this, which is important, but why didn't you do more? All of that is essentially a normalization process,
Yes, it is.
which is now very manifest, but not so manifest in the first 50 years. I think some of the truth embargo managers viewed it as normalization, but I mean, come on, 40 years of normalization,
Well,
please.
that was an extreme normalization, I think.
Yeah.
And even to the point of ridicule of a lot of people, I found it funny that the very first document released in the tranche was somebody from, I believe it may have been APRO at the time. One of the first, like 1952, like one of the first, UFO, citizen UFO investigation organizations. Very first document out of the gate in the first tranche was this gentleman who belonged to APRO, who wrote a letter to J. Edgar Hoover, letting him know that he belonged to this citizen organization that looked into UFOs and strange science, and that we have a Congress every year, and this is what we talked about. And just so you know, I am not a communist.
No, that is true.
It was like, that's how far back the ridicule of witnesses and people investigating and things like that go, and how deep it goes. The fact that, like, yeah, they were labeling them communists, man.
Well, they labeled everybody communists
Oh,
back then, but they're
absolutely.
starting to do it again. But let me
Close
say
to it.
this. History will show, I believe, that 90% of all the work that was being done back then and the things that people were coming out with and saying, look, we did this, we did this, all that's going to prove to be true. All right. They did it with very little money, without necessarily college degrees. And they created organizations that the government worked to shut down, succeeded in some cases, not in others, but 90% is going to be true. And that's extraordinary. Right. If a bunch of scientists come together, top of the field, you know, and they're working at CERN and they discover a new particle, people go, ah, it's a great thing. But what if some common regular people, you know, because nobody would do this, discovered a new particle? I mean, it'd be unbelievable. Well, that's an extreme case. I'm simply saying that you're going to find out that 90% of that is true. And so the other thing is that what was I was going to say, I've lost it, but. Let me also mention this. I'm gearing up for the post-disclosure world. I think that most of the knowledgeable people are doing the same. Danny Sheehan, I believe, is also the Disclosure Foundation. All the newer organizations that the organizations and some of the military guys are creating, Safe Space, all of that. They're doing this not because, oh, this will help get end the truth embargo. No. I mean, it helps a little bit, but it's not necessarily what you do. They're doing it because they know the truth embargo is about to end, and they want that organization in place when it does.
That's right.
Because the real, the ending of the truth embargo is a 30-second thing, and the post-disclosure, the pre-disclosure world is over. The disclosure event takes 30 seconds, and then the post-disclosure era begins, and it will go on forever. And that's when the real work begins. I mean, the amount of work and opportunities and things that can be engaged and everything else and dealing with all of it and so forth will be huge. And that's what they're looking forward to because while disclosure event is, I think, the biggest event in human history, the post-disclosure world is another era. There have been era changes, but this is unlike any other. And so everybody that's still alive post-disclosure is going to be able to participate in this era in ways we don't even know yet. And some we do. And it's going to be incredibly exciting. And hopefully it will be so transformative that we will back off the nuclear arms race. We'll back off most of the crap that we're doing, the religious murders and all that slaughter. And we'll go, wait a minute, we're not alone. And Let's clean up our house,
Yeah.
right? I mean, it's crazy to do all this. I mean, what to do what? To be a little higher, status on the planet when there's probably civilizations out there that just look at us and go, oh, that's interesting. Get back to us in 10,000 years, we can talk. So I'm hoping that's what's going to happen. It's a very nebulous thing. I don't have the academic ability to write it out in a paper where it describes how the end
Yeah.
of the truth embargo in very complicated ways will start shifting. I have that ability. There are other people that'll do that. I'm the guy that's supposed to keep talking about it, so somebody much smarter than I will actually go, okay, let's get a team of people together and look at the post-disclosure era. And having said that, you can bet your life savings on any government in this world that has got massive tech, which includes supercomputers, and now AI and supercomputers,
Yeah.
has been gaming the post-disclosure world for some time. They have been running the scenarios through them and through them and through them, meaning, okay, if we get disclosure and the whole world learns we're not alone, what happens in that industry? What happens in this area? What's the psychology? What they game in forever? Can't say it, can't publish it,
Yeah.
right? I could be wrong, but I mean, it's common sense. Right? If you're the government and you have this kind of power, you're just going to say, well, we'll see what happens. And I actually know that they've done some research. I know of
Oh,
one
sure.
major public relations firm that was given a big contract by the Pentagon to study the whole thing, disclosure and post-disclosure.
Oh,
And
sure.
he got a report back about 8 years later, and
Well,
nobody
it's.
knows about it. I got that from an inside source. I don't talk about it because what's the point? Really, I mean, I don't get into big deal.
Yeah.
Whatever, it's common sense. They game everything, and they have gamed the post-disclosure world.
Yeah.
Now the question is, and this is why we need transparency: are they gaming the post-disclosure world to see how, in that context, they can invade here, invade there, or economically dominate this continent, or whatever the
Yeah.
hell, by utilizing these changes? Or are they gaming how we can solve problems and eliminate the destructive behavior and so forth? We don't know. They may be doing both, right? But let me tell you, let me put it this way. If I had to call the shots on post-disclosure the first year, the year and a half, I think there is going to be some evidence emerging that significant pre-analysis of the post-disclosure era, which would include, in many cases, actual understanding of the tech and everything else,
Yeah.
has been done for military reasons and maybe even for what we'll call inappropriate business reasons, but certainly military reasons, national security. And we're going to define that, yes, there's also been a lot of gaming in terms of how this transition could get us out of the mess that we're in. All right. And that's going to kind of emerge. And I got to tell you, if you've got to put your poly market money down on which one is going to prevail or dominate, you've got to put your money on the weaponization
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
tech and also the weaponization of tech for monetary purposes, which means that this will not end well, which is one of the reasons why I continue to predict, based upon everything I've seen and heard about this issue, and what I know about ETs, which is, not a lot, but it's a decent amount. Mostly from contactees, is that there is an agenda here, and that agenda includes open contact after disclosure. 6 months, a year, year and a half, 2 years is about right, maybe sooner, because again, a lot of stuff is going to start happening post-disclosure that could be dangerous. It could be a real problem because there's going to be an opportunity to do stuff that you couldn't do before. And for those that just love taking things over, blowing things up, killing people, whatever, dominating, ruining the world, they're going to do it. Open contact would be the appropriate thing if you're the ETs and your intentions are fundamentally good. At that point, you intervene in a sense, right? You
Yeah.
come in and say, look, right, we're here. Now we want to talk,
Yeah.
right? I'm not saying we're sitting down at a Starbucks, but I mean, there's communication going on a lot of ways, and we're at least informed about it. And they can start expressing opinions,
Yeah.
not just doing things that, turning off missiles to make a point. But expressing opinions, meaning, okay, you can go this direction. Some of us did. It's not good. You want to go this direction, right? And you have to do this. You have to get rid of the nukes. This is insane. You don't do this. We understood this was insane 5,000 years ago. And countries and civilizations that didn't get it, they blew themselves up. And occasionally we visit their ashes. Whatever. They're going to be making opinions that are going to be hard to ignore. Now, there'll be some leaders in this world that are so gone that they will nothing can persuade them, but it doesn't matter. If enough of the world's ruling class are rulers, heads of state, get the point and start to realize, okay, we're not alone, and we're actually talking to some of these other people that we are involved with or here, and they're giving some pretty good information, some pretty good advice, and they're taking it. And the last thing I'll say about that is that the immediate response that someone should give me is that, why do we give a damn what they want or think? Okay, we'll do what we want. Screw you. All right. Well, that's a possible response. It is. And with respect to a lot of things we do down here, we might just well do that. In other words, we don't care about the pollution in the Pacific Ocean, so don't start ragging on that. Okay, it's we'll clean it up one day, but we don't care right now. And that may be the case, except when what we are doing poses any threat to them. Okay, that's a different matter. Now, at this point, this is not a discussion. They certainly need to have that discussion in 1900 or 2000. Well, maybe 2000 it starts to become an issue. And that's simple. If you look at the last 125 years from 1900, the explosion of scientific and technology, scientific understanding and technological power, and it's just been vertical. I mean, it's going like this. It's going so fast that now it went it's going back to around 1900. The world that you were born into will be almost unrecognizable by the time you get to be 70 or 75, and it's like, I'm out of here, right? I don't know what the hell's going on. I'm starting to feel that now, right? Okay. And that's incredible. And it's going to continue. I mean, assuming we don't blow ourselves up, it's going to continue. So when you said, well, when we will have this, another 1,000 years, now, pick a tech. And it may very well be we'll have it in 6 months, we'll have it in a year. But the most important tech, if I'm right and they're extraterrestrial, and again, I'm right. Well, how would I say it? It's not that, how would I say it? I got to say it properly. It's not, I can't remember. It's a famous quote on Ancient Aliens. It's not that they're, it says, it's not that they're extraterrestrial. Anyway, look,
I'm not saying it's aliens, but it's
I'm not
aliens.
saying it's aliens. It's aliens.
But it's
I'm not
aliens.
saying they're extraterrestrials. They're extraterrestrials. I got to trademark that. I got to trademark it. So look, so we are not the, if they are from the stars, and I believe they are, I believe our ability to figure that out is very close. It's very close. You can research it. You don't have to take my word for it. You'll get some stuff that's fringe, but you'll also get some stuff that looks pretty heavy, right? But one thing's for sure, you know that the best scientists in the world in that area are trying to figure it out. And if the government knows they're extraterrestrial, okay, because you know, when oftentimes when a contactee or an abductee is on the craft, they're not always just out cold. Sometimes they're, you know, they're lucid, and they'll get to say something, and they'll telepathically ask. Well, or ask the ET, you know, things like, do you believe in God or where are you from? And as far as I know, and there have been hundreds of thousands of contactee reports that are in the files of various researchers, as well as hundreds that have been, you know, put into book form. No ET has ever said we're from the future. They've never said we're from another dimension. They say they're from the stars. And so I tend to believe them. All right. And so the government's had a number of ETs. Well, the government hasn't had just dead ETs in its possession. The evidence points to live ETs. Okay. And so the government could have asked them that question. We know you're not going to live very long because, unfortunately, you know, we don't have the right food and, you know, the air conditioning is not good here. But where are you from? And it wouldn't surprise you, we're from the stars. Which star? I might even told them which star. And so if that is the case, the government's always known they're extraterrestrial. And if that is true, then you bet your bottom dollar for 60, 70 years, they have been doing everything they can to figure how they can get from one star to another. And if they had a live ET, and assuming he even knew, he'd be damn fool to tell them. Why? Because The moment we have the ability to go to another star and say 6 months, 3 months, whatever, something along those lines. Okay. Yeah. Even 2 or 3 years, that's not that often.
Yep.
Being who we are, we're going to load the ships up with proton torpedoes and, you know, some nuclear weapons. Some
just in case.
Because, you know, you've got to be too careful.
Yeah.
Right? You're going to where no man's gone before. It's very, yeah, we're going to do that. And the moment we do that, we are a threat to every civilization near us going out, you know, including them.
Yeah.
But yeah, because maybe they have good surveillance systems. But, you know, you turn up from nowhere. Next thing you know, you're throwing a bomb in some poor civilizations about where we were in the 1100s and killing people. Because the civilizations from elsewhere that have visited us maybe in the ancient past, overall, the evidence is they didn't come to kill, destroy everybody. They were just kind of, you know, hanging out and getting treated like gods.
Yeah.
The ETs that we're dealing with since, 1947, 45 rather, don't seem to be intent on slaughtering us, killing us, or anything else. I think they're probably reasonable. And since they're reasonable, they don't want to blow up civilizations. But we could. And so when it comes to that, okay, and so I'm thinking the conversation goes like this. Okay, you want to clean up your ocean? Fine. That's fine. But you're not going to have nukes. And they're going to say, yes, we are. Well, I mean, you can have nukes, but you'll never leave this solar system. Yeah. You'll never leave this planet. In fact, one will never get operational. You build the damn thing. It'll be almost finished. You're ready to, you know, give it a certification. You're going to melt it down into some nice metal that you can reuse, something like that. But you are never leaving this planet because we are not idiots.
Yeah, we won't let you.
You are too dangerous. Now, one day, you might be ready to hang out with us out here. But first, you get rid of the nukes, okay? And if you think that we don't have the ability to detect any nukes you want to hide under your porch, we can pretty much detect anything. And that will be a discussion. And that alone, if we in fact said, well, look, we don't want to do this other stuff you're mentioning, but we will get rid of the nukes. And we lift the mutual assured destruction umbrella off of us and are left with only conventional war, mostly with drones, which we finally go, what is the point?
Yeah.
Right? And start backing away from who we were when World War I started, and II started, and the nuclear arms race started. All of a sudden, a whole lot of things start becoming possible that just simply weren't. And perhaps in 5 or 10 or 20 years, it's kumbaya here on the planet. Everybody's getting along. The UN's got great meetings. People actually listen to each other. The idea of conventional war seems to almost, you know, is degrading because huge conventional war stocks are being reduced.
Yeah.
Now it's getting down to the point where it's mostly, you know, for keeping order. And the ETs could say, you know, you've done so much. You've done so well in the last 5 years. I think you're ready. I think you're ready. So let's talk about the next 5 years, you know? You know, without the context of this entire history of the ET issue, that statement I just made is fantasy. It's like Alice in Wonderland. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But if you know that 80-year history reasonably well, you know, and I know it about 15%, 10% of what Richard Dolan wants, so he might have a different view, but I wouldn't be surprised if he felt similar. That is not an unreasonable conclusion to come to.
No.
Because if you're going to finally get it together, if you're going to finally decide enough is enough, it is likely going to happen when you're on the edge of literally annihilating most of the human race, polluting the planet. It'll kill hundreds of thousands or millions of other species and possibly creating other effects. At that point is when you would finally say, okay, and we are at that point. And it's not just nuclear, because nuclear weapons is one thing.
Yeah.
But we have other things that are potentially capable of destroying us. And the ETs are going to say, don't do that. And what am I talking about? We are approaching artificial intelligence at a level that these language models, extreme, what do you call it? Universal intelligence, I forget the name for it, are literally going to tell you how to build from scratch an organism that cannot be stopped. There is no way to stop it from killing the host. And even an organism that will kill anybody that gets it, and there's no way to cure it, but will only kill people of a certain, how would you say, ethnicity,
Oh yeah.
background,
That was,
whatever.
it's very interesting that you bring that up. One of the things that we bring up regularly on the show is actually the Wuhan lab. And it was back in like 2012 that France was one of the countries that was behind the funding of it. We helped fund
Yeah,
it,
sure.
all kinds of things. But France went to the UN and backed out. And they were like, listen, we're leaving this project. Because apparently China wants to build ethno-specific viruses, and we won't have any part of that. So
Oh,
just
you know,
blowing the
is
whistle
that
on the
a
way out the door.
you have a good source on that ethno-specific viruses?
I'd
Do you
have
have?
to find the articles, but I'll look it up
Okay,
and
all
send
right.
it to
Okay.
you.
Well, see what I mean? Now, what happened at MUFON, whatever the name that
Yeah.
lab was. What's the name of that lab again?
Wuhan, the
Okay,
Wuhan
anyway,
lab.
Wuhan lab. My memory's not what it used to be
It's
because I'm
okay, bro.
incredibly old. What that was happening there is trivial.
Oh,
That's nothing
absolutely.
compared to what full out artificial intelligence language can platforms can do. And so, and there have been a number of books about this. There's a famous book by the same guy that did what was the thing he wrote? Oh, Dune. He wrote a book called The White Plague. And it's, nobody's really heard of that book. It's a long time ago, but
Frank
it's a pretty
Herbert.
good book. Yeah, Herbert. And The White Plague is about a gentleman who loses his family to a terrorist bomb. And he is a scientist, and he just loses his mind. He's incredibly angry. He loses his whole family. And so he invents a virus that will kill every woman it gets into, and there's nothing to stop it. And he spreads the virus by putting it on money so that it just starts passing around the world. It's called the White Plague. So, and this is from pretty 40 some years ago. This has been out there. But again, artificial, they made it quite, there's a number of top experts have already gone there that perhaps the artificial intelligence used to create literally living entities to spec is, well, it could be great if you're talking about everybody, being 6'4" and in fantastic health and living to 130, that's fine. But you know how it is. This is not what we do. To spec is an unbelievable threat. And so while that's a little, we could have a nuclear war tomorrow, that's a little further down the line. Okay. And so open contact and dealing with the, if we're able to deal with the nuclear threat, which is imminent and ready to go, I think a legitimate world discussion about we're not going to allow incredibly intelligent AI to be used in any way to create pathogens to spec that can literally slaughter people, including the entire planet, if you're really serious. We're just not going to allow that. We're going to come together and not compete with each other, right? In other words, I don't really want to do this, but that country's doing this, so I'm going to do it. And maybe we can get through that one. Because that's not, these are not the only existential threats that this vertical technological scientific trend is under. There's more coming we don't even know about. And so it comes down to this: a viable civilization still extant on this planet moving forward in time, I think, literally hangs on whether we can actually get disclosure, get into open contact with these other ETs, and God knows how many there are. And assuming they don't blow us up, help us to finally break through this part of our evolution so that we can continue and be an advanced extraterrestrial civilization, starfaring 500 years from now, maybe visiting other stars, which seems to be what kind of what happens. That's not that unrealistic. I don't think I'm, just literally, Pollyanna, whatever, what do you call it? I mean, you're just, just being ridiculously, absurdly, not only optimistic, but unrealistic. Because I just didn't start thinking this way last week. This is the thinking that's developed over 3 decades, focused explicitly on this issue, both in terms of the phenomena, but not as a researcher, but also the political implications, at the same time, because I've always been doing that, paying attention to the foolishness of nations and leaders and all the bad things they're doing, which now we know more about than ever. You can't be a dictator anymore and start slaughtering people, and it's all over the freaking news within a couple of weeks. There used to be a time you could get away with that. You could kill off half the population. Nobody would find out until some historian wrote about it, 500 years later. So it's getting harder and harder to be an asshole on the planet, but still, they're here and they're very dangerous. And so, based on all of that, this is where I'm at. This is my view. I hope I'm wrong. I hope there's another way out of this, but I'll tell you, no one has ever even attempted to offer up. I mean, religious people believe. And by the way, these kinds of intractable situations are not uncommon. I mean, more localized, but they've happened in the past where a situation was simply unsolvable and people are incredibly suffering and terrible things are coming. And they turn to their God, their faith. And that's where messianism comes from.
Well,
Hopefully that will happen and save us.
and there's reasons why NASA in their panel a few years ago on extraterrestrial life, like literally brought in 12 theologians to talk about these things. The way, I mean, the
Sure.
Brookings Institute brought in religious professionals back in 1952 to talk about the possible impacts of what if we find something, and that's where the protocol of tell them nothing came
Well, yeah, but
from.
this is happening. This is another indication of why we're almost to disclosure. In fact, as you know, I chronicle, I log in, and post thousands and thousands of articles, and I'm triaging everything in the mainstream press. And increasingly, more and more religious papers are writing about this. I've got
Absolutely.
maybe 20 or 30 that I just put up in the last about year, and so all that's very good. Okay, but what I was referring to is that. There is a messianic quality to the disclosure movement and ETs. Okay. And some people get all ruffled by that. And, that's stupid and silly, right? No. Over the centuries, there have been many messiahs and plenty of messianism. And without trying to be disrespectful, by and large, they didn't do anything. Right? I mean, it's not like, yeah, somebody showed up and wow, things really got well. No. But for the people that were suffering, messianism was very helpful. It made it
Absolutely.
easier to get through it. Right? Having some hope that somehow something very powerful, even with godlike powers, could actually intervene and straighten it all out. Okay. What's different about all the previous messianism prior to this and the quote example that we're looking at now, or the potential, is somewhat similar example, is that these guys have the ability to, in fact, make things better. They're real. I mean, they are in the physical world. They are as physical as we are. They have extraordinary tech. They're in this world and they seem to care about us to some degree. And so they actually, if you want to call them messiahs, fine, but they're the ones that are finally going to deliver. And we are owed that. I mean, after all the messiahs that showed up and really weren't able to make things much better, we're owed a messiah that comes in and goes, okay, we're fixing this, we're fixing that. And if they come in groups, I don't care. And so there's that, something to think of.
And it is fascinating, man. Like I'll be speaking at MUFON this year, and part of what I'm talking about is the cross section of science, humanity, and UFOs. And you, as a former Catholic seminarian, the one thing that I have been holding up on a pedestal is the fact that the Catholic Church divested the exorcist in Washington, D.C. after he was publicly stating on a podcast like this that all UFOs are demonic in origin. And like literally
That's very interesting.
right over my shoulder, right here on the second shelf, is a copy of the Roman Ritual, Latin on the left, English on the right. And there's a very descript process for investigating demonic possession and what a demon is. So if you are saying in a blanket statement that all of these are demonic, you are no longer following that manual. You are not
This is.
following your investigative protocols, and we are divesting you because you're speaking in the name of the church, and that's not what we think or believe.
I'm glad you brought that up. That's very significant. It's
It's
another
huge,
example of moving
huge,
forward, right?
massive.
The Catholic Church has been ahead of this curve for a long time.
Yes, they have
They've made
been.
a lot of positive statements. And so it's it goes against where they're trying to position themselves. And there's also this, if you've got a lot of Catholics out there saying they're demons and they turn up and they're not demons, that doesn't reflect well in the Catholic Church. All right, there's that. And so the Pope didn't have to do anything there, but I think by doing that, he's basically saying, yeah, like other popes who have said some important things, and other members of the Vatican have said things, I'm there too. All right, and that's very important. The Catholic Church is going to be a big stabilizing force post-disclosure, right? And that's important. And I think that that is very helpful. There's been demon talk for a long time. In fact, it's even exists, and we know it exists over the DOD,
Coming from our
and
vice
even
president publicly.
and the vice president kind of went there. I don't think he slammed it, but it's like, yeah, because he is religious. But I don't think he. I'm not criticizing him. I
No,
don't think he knows
absolutely
enough about
not.
this subject
I just thought
history.
that it was very interesting that somebody of that ilk made that exact statement, that there was no question that some of them were, some of them weren't, all of them are, was
And to
the
all my friends
statement.
out there, they say disclosure is never going to happen. I have still plenty to say that. I say friends, people on X, right? Think back to all the other vice presidents that made a point of coming out and telling the public, I think this phenomenon is actually demons. These are demons. These are not extraterrestrials. And think about it. Did anybody? No, that's never happened before. And that never happened before is piling up. And so, look, disclosure is going to come. I'm not going to be going on podcasts and yelling, I told you so. At least I hope not, because that would be wrong. And that's pointless. And
You
it's an
have the
activist.
right to, but you won't.
Let's just say that I will be very
Fully
happy and
reserve the
pleased.
right, and you should.
No, it would
But
be
it
a
doesn't
huge
mean that
mistake.
you should celebrate in that kind of way. Absolutely not.
But I'll tell you this. Anybody that comes up to me, however they approach me, and basically says, I just didn't think it was possible, but it was. And that's a good thing. And I'm thanks. My respect for them will be very, very high.
Yeah, same. And as we wrap this, man, number one, I want to thank you for the massive amount of extra time, Stephen. It's been an amazing conversation, and I want to
My
thank you
job.
for your candid conversation tonight. And it really is the fact of we have to prepare ourselves for this. Even those of us who are in this world of investigation, in this world of research. We have to prepare ourselves for it too, because it's still a conversation, and it's still something that we have to be open-minded about. I say regularly on this show, I am not a debunker. I help demystify things for people. That's my job. Aside from that, I am proudly a skeptic with an S on his chest like Superman, and I am ready to pull it out anytime. My job as a skeptic is to be looking for the data that changes my mind. And to have an open enough mind to be willing to have it changed. That's that. And now I'm a, that I say that because I'm a believer. I've had my experiences, Stephen. So I've got to ballast myself in the same way the Catholic Church just did, where they're like, hey, believer with a collar
That's fine.
who's had your experiences, you still need to be unbiased in your investigation. You cannot
But
be investigating to prove your faith.
let's parse this a little bit, though.
Please go ahead.
I'm not a believer, I'm a knower.
Yeah.
There's a difference between believing and knowing.
Oh,
And
absolutely.
it can be subtle, but there is a difference. Being a believer was a safe place to be, and a lot of people went there, even though they knew that there was this presence, because it's safer. Saying you know is another matter. So in terms of this larger issue, of course, as we go forward, everything that is coming out, you need to have a baseline skeptical view, right? And about this and about that, this testimony and this, whatever. That's perfectly okay.
Absolutely.
But when the cumulative totality of the evidence, because some of it may be a little off, some of it not, but all of it, no, there's no way, confirms something. That's not believing, that's knowing. And so, based upon all that's been accomplished and done and understood on this issue in the last 80 years, I am absolutely certain of this presence. It is not a belief by any means. And so I'm not skeptical about that. And while the time travel stuff and everything is something, I don't want to just throw overboard, I give it a tiny chance, right? Someone has got to produce some serious evidence for that. And mostly they come up with a little spin, whatever. It's sci-fi and it's pretty cool. But on this, I know. And that is a minority of the people that are in and on board on board the disclosure train right now. The vast majority are probably they believe it's true,
Well,
and there's a certain minority that know it's true.
and let me back walk for a second, because really it's the fact of what I'm skeptical about is anything that comes out or that I hear. I'm willing to hear it. I'm willing to have the conversation. But until proven otherwise, I will always hold my skepticism. But like you said, there is enough of a w overwhelming body of evidence that is it there? Absolutely. I have zero doubt in the fact that it's there. The only thing that
Well,
I doubt is stories like what come out from the New York Times, where we find out that the U.S. government has been gaslighting us for years on purpose with these topics because, well, we eat them up, so why not use them?
that's another reason to be
Things like
skeptical
that.
if you're dealing with political intervention
Well, and that's just it. And that's what we need a healthy dose of skepticism with. Whenever you see the news stories, yes, it's beautiful. The conversation is now open. Thank God. But man, don't forget the pinch of salt to go with it. You know what I mean?
Sure. Here's an analogy.
Please.
For a long time, there was speculation that the Earth was round. It was little hints and clues and this and that, but it wasn't accepted. The Catholic Church absolutely didn't accept it,
We
and
burned
so
people
there were a
because
lot
of
of people who believed the world was round. When they sailed around it, they knew it was round. Okay, so in that sense, you have this concept, I think, a little more simply made, meaning this: there is potential. There was at probably some point more than enough totality of evidence the world was round that a person that understood it knew it was round. But for most people, they didn't know that, and so
Exactly.
they literally had to happen. And so for a lot of people, these ETs are really going to have to become absolutely outed in a sense and known. Up until then, they're just a believer, but I did study science. That was science and math. I didn't go there, but still, that's what I did most. And so I learned, as everybody should, but it's becoming harder and harder, how to consider a spectrum of evidence, right? And a spectrum, a group of it, understanding that not all of it may be established, but what's the implications of the totality? And this is part of science. You have a lot of scientists that are searching something that they absolutely know is true. They just can't demonstrate it yet. And the reason they know it's true is there is a whole amount of evidence. So if they're wise, they would, again, it's appropriate. The safe play is when talking to other colleagues, I believe that such and such is the case with respect to that. And I'm looking into it rather than I know that is the case and I'm going to show it.
Kind of like
Belief is that safe place. And it's a problem, though, when you're dealing with an issue of this
this
magnitude.
is,
Strange phenomena. Bye.
this is an actual scientific desk reference, man, that
Oh,
has
good.
articles going back to the 1600s, all kinds of stuff about crop circles.
Really? Never
I
seen that. Who
got
is
this.
who?
I got this at a MUFON conference at the bookstore
Right.
for like $5.
Does it have an author?
There's a whole compilation. William G. Corliss. This one was actually printed in, I want to say it was 1974 was the last year of publication.
74.
Something like that.
Okay, I will bet you that 90% of the stuff in that book from 74 will prove out.
Well,
I think a
this is
lot of
all
it.
things, and it's strange phenomena.
Well,
This is
maybe not.
all
Maybe if it's all over the place,
Well,
maybe not, but.
this is all articles on things like, ball lightning, things like that, strange phenomena that have been recorded
Okay.
throughout history. So if you, but that's just it. So this is part of science. It's an active part of
It
science is to get rid of the phenomena in your data set, so much so that they have desk references on how to get rid of the phenomena in your data set. Here's some things that it might be, and that's fascinating to think about, that so much so that that is there. So the fact that scientists are now on board, I've said since the beginning of UAP, it was sneaky as heck that they changed it. Don't get me wrong, but it brought science in kicking and screaming because you've got to get rid of phenomena in your data set.
Publicly on board.
Yeah.
Publicly
yeah,
on board.
Exactly.
Many years ago, 20 years ago, I went to a party in Bethesda, right?
Yeah.
At the house of a couple of U.S. Navy scientists, right? The Navy labs.
Yep.
They had huge UFO library in their basement.
I wouldn't doubt
they
it.
They have been on board for a lot longer than you may know, but the truth embargo has kept them from actually talking about it. And now they can. Let me tell you, the potential for an avalanche of high-level scientists and so forth able to come forward and say, you know, yeah that's true.
Hey.
Yeah, It'll be like an avalanche once the door is open.
And I can tell you right now, as a seminarian, amongst the things that we studied, like philosophy, theology, things like that, that we talked around the dinner and lunch table about, the existential quandary of what would happen and what would just be the thought of humanity should we have contact from outside was a regular course of conversation at the table.
Sure.
It was a regular course of philosophic debate.
Yeah.
You know, what would it do? So these are things that, you know, when you're looking at popes, priests, bishops, things like that, that are coming in right now. Yeah. They're people that were 10 years ahead of me, 15 years ahead of me in cases, you know, 20 years. So it's not that far removed. And the fact that they are having this conversation at that level is fantastic. The fact that we're now seeing this conversation publicly from our federal government in the halls of Congress, on TV, on live streams, is phenomenal. And it's all because of work of people like you, Stephen, who have been out here,
others.
Who have been chipping away at this mountain, trying to dig a tunnel through it for decades. So thank you for your work. Thank you.
I wish I could have dug deeper and harder. But, you know, the religion thing is non-trivial. Post-disclosure, I think there's a consensus. At least I think that, right? I think there's a consensus. Religion will be fine. In fact, might even grow.
Oh, absolutely.
But again, it's still going to be tricky. Hopefully no one religion will try to make it its own or just not you know, be reasonable. But we do have multiple faiths on this planet. People talk about religion. Well, there's more than one religion.
Yeah.
And they've been in conflict for a long time. And so one of the problems about Messiah coming to Earth, right? What if it's not your religion?
So
Messiah's arrived. It's not your religion. So, I'm sorry, I can't help
that. That used to be my joke all the time is, what if we die, get up there, and find out it's Buddha, guys?
Yeah.
Like, Buddha. What then? What then?
So I think the post-disclosure, but in general, most religions will be impressed that their God's creation is even more profound and grand than they thought. And of course, Webb telescope has done that, right? I mean, Webb is showing you how great this creation is.
Honestly, it's also, I think, a very myopic and a very Western point of view to think that it's going to crash anything, because 3/4 of the world is not Christian of faith. They are of faiths that this has been a part of their tradition, Vedic tradition, Buddhist tradition. They talk about this stuff openly for millennia, to the point that, like, if you look at quantum entangled photons, there's no question it is a yin yang. Like, there's no, like, maybe it looks like a yin yang. It's a yin yang. And that changed the conversation, man. Changed the conversation with quantum physics. And suddenly scientists started running to paranormal. They started running to these things that have been talking about this, that have been talking about this connection of vibration, this connection of density of the universe, of strange, spooky action at a distance, like what Einstein talked about. And that's what ETs are utilizing to travel through, to jump from point to point, so to speak, to shrink space, reopen it, and then they're somewhere else. You know, things like that.
To get back to a point you just referred to, you're right.
Yeah.
Almost all the other religions in the world
got no problem with it. Zero problem.
They don't have much of a problem. It is the Christian faith that has more likely to have the problem.
The crisis of conscience.
The church is a concern because at one time long ago, they really brutally resisted science.
We kind of controlled the dialogue in a hard way.
Exactly. And then on the Protestant side, or the other non-Catholic sects, you have a group that is they're referred to as the fundamentalists. And because they're extremely fundamental and rigid, anything that undermines that structure, they view as almost existential.
Yeah.
Now, their numbers are not large, but still, that's true. So when the Catholic Church makes the clear decision that it is going to get on the side of science here and is going to be comfortable with integrating this new reality, I think that was going to make it easier for the Protestants certainly to do it as well. And therefore, they did a great service to the world on that. And they're talking about Ducci and Funes and some statements from the various popes. They should get respect for that. They should be honored for that.
Absolutely.
The Catholic Church needs a win like that because it's had some bad losses.
It's had a few knocks.
That's important. Yeah. So, again, I'm just not worried about the post-disclosure world. There's other things worrying me to death.
Yeah.
Right?
No. Okay. We worry me to death. They don't. They don't. Because honestly, I don't think they leave their lights on accidentally. Number one.
Sure.
And number two, my God, man, if they were here for nefarious purpose, I think we'd have found out in a really horrible way a long time ago.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I
absolutely.
Mean? Like in a worse than a Zachariah Ascension way. You know, like I think it'd be worse than us just digging gold for the aliens, you know?
It's a bit of a shame that what I believe are the basically fundamentally good intentions of the ETs was so corrupted by the necessary propaganda that had to be put out by the government to maintain the truth embargo.
Yep.
Scary, frightening, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a bad rap. It's like getting shade put on you. But of course, you know, we're Absolutely. On the internet, so we are used to that. I don't know if they're on the internet, but it's a shame. But whatever. We did what we did. I'm sure that every civilization that evolves to where we were in the year 1945 had to go through something like this at some point. They've all gone through it, and I'm sure it's turned out very different in many ways. It would be cool to learn one day, well, here are some examples. Let me explain to you a little history of some other star systems. That would be kind of cool.
Yep.
I mean, this is ours, and we still have a chance to make it work, as we have done in the past in some cases, where we have made work a difficult situation and moved on. Like slavery was something that we had to move on from.
Mm-hmm.
It took a long time. It took 400 years. But we did. Okay. Still a little left over, but still. This is even bigger than that.
It's
we have to
massive.
Move on from where we are. And the ETs are here. And let's hope it works out. I'm going to have to call it a night.
Well, I want to thank you for the epically long time tonight. It was a beautiful conversation, and like I said before we started this evening, we need to have you on again and again. It's too much fun every time you're on. It's always a great conversation, and truly again, thank you for all that you do for the cause, for everything that you have done to help bring this to the forefront of the halls of Congress and the Hill the way that you have. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to follow you, where they can go to keep up with everything that is Paradigm Research Group and all of your great work.
Look, I'm on X. I'd love people to subscribe to X. You can search me, Stephen Bassett, Paradigm Research Group. I think I'm at Stephen Bassett. But yeah, I welcome more subscribers. I don't have a podcast. I'm not an influencer. So I got a mere 42,000, but I'd love to have another 42. So there's that. Paradigm Research Group site is under some improvements. I'm going to work on that. But that's where you can find still a lot
awesome.
Of information regarding the activism, paradigmresearchgroup.org. Also, the Hollywood Disclosure Alliance, which I co-founded with Dan Harari, is really doing good work and making
great
progress
strides
in LA and also around the country. We have over 252 members in this free, basically free networking group that helping them get together to create stories, content. Right. So that the UAP people and the hotshot producing people will be able to benefit from each other. And that's a worth, if you think you should belong to it, let us know, get in touch. And that's good. And then, of course, I think the number one activist organization on this issue in the world is the New Paradigm Institute. They have the staff, the money, and the resources, and would need more resources. And by the way, everything I just mentioned are all nonprofits, all with pay, donation things. New Paradigm Institute, get behind it. And if you're a philanthropist and you would like to make a mark in this extraordinary time, drop a couple of million on the New Paradigm Institute and watch what they do with it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Stephen, once again, thank you so much for tonight. Thank you so much for the last 30 years of your hard and diligent work on this topic. We can't wait to have you on again. I'll be in touch with links soon, my friend.
Yeah, don't wait another year. Okay?
I won't. I won't. I promise.
All right.
All right. Take care, man. We'll talk to you soon. Always, always a great conversation with Stephen Bass. I'm sorry for the technical issues that were out there, folks. I got texts from a couple folks who tune in every now and then saying that there was some issue with some of the audio at the beginning. That audio will be replaced, guaranteed, by the end of tonight, by the end of this episode. That whole audio track, the episode will be released audio-wise, so you can go listen to it. But in the meantime, the video will be re-uploaded to YouTube for perpetuity, all that kind of good stuff, folks. So do not worry. You will be getting everything from us as always. When we come back from this quick commercial break, everybody, we will be joined by the amazing Sylvie Sterling. We will be talking about Lyrid aliens. Speaking of aliens, we will be talking about cat aliens and her connection with them, as well as her connection with cats. And what it is to be a cat whisperer, and what we can learn from our furry friends that we may not be aware of. We'll get into that with her right after this, folks.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick commercial break. Thank you so much for staying with us. And also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you're a user of CBD products like I am, stop on by TrueHempScience.com today. Christopher Lynch and True Hemp Science use a spigeric process where every part of the hemp plant is used. That's every part, folks. Stems, seeds, leaves, buds. Every part is used, combusted, reused, and that process followed time and time again until nothing remains. But an amazing spigeric product complete with terpene profiles and all. Stop on by TrueHempScience.com today. They are my choice for CBD products, and I hope they become yours. Use the code CURIOUS7 to get 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more while you're there, and get free edibles on your way out the door. Our guest in this segment is Bob Spearing. He is the Director of International Development at MUFON. You can find out more information about MUFON, becoming a MUFON investigator, becoming a lifetime member like myself, over at MUFON.com. You can find out information about the MUFON Symposium this year over at MUFONSymposium.com. I will actually be speaking at this year's symposium about the impact of UFOs on society and science. I am more than excited to present this topic. It is something near and dear to my heart. And welcome back to the show, Bob Spearing. How are you, my friend?
I'm good. How are you, Chris? Good to be back. Good to see you.
Absolutely, man. Always great to have you on. I always love having MUFON on because there is so much to talk about when it comes to society, UFOs, UAPs, everything happening. Even right now, we had a little bit of conversation beforehand. We had a little bit of conversation a week or so ago with Ron James on the show about movies and Disclosure Day and things like that. And it's fascinating to see the conversations and where these things go and where people take them, you know, all the way from, oh my God, I hated the movie to, Steven Spielberg is a tool of the U.S. government to like and like I said in our pre-conversation, I think a lot of the movie was his answer to 35 years of people's speculation, 50 years, actually. Like that Close Encounters came out, I guess, when I was like three, like 78, something like that. So, you know, it's been around for a hot minute. And for about that long, people have been saying that he is like a tool of the U.S. government, that he is read into programs. And he's like, No, I'm not. I've hired some pretty big name consultants who have worked with the government, like Jacques Vallée and stuff like that. But like, I've never held materials. I don't know where they hold that stuff. So, it's been interesting to see these things. And like you said, it will be interesting because it is very much an experiencer-based movie.
Absolutely.
It is definitely a message to experiencers, that no doubt that, and onboarding the general public to the topic, not of UFO and craft, but to the topic of experiencer and what an experiencer is. Because more than you think that a lot of people don't know about or aren't into UFOs, you know, imagine how many people don't know about or are not into the abductees, the experiencers, the people who have had those kind of fantastic experiences, Bob.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. In the 1950s, most of the experiences people perceived, they were contactees that met the Space Brothers or the, you know, the Federation, and, you know, got to go on, you know, trips in a spaceship. And then it seems the phenomenon turned darker in the 80s, gradually picking up steam after the Benny and Barney Hill thing in 1960. But there was a sinister aspect to it more recently. But I think the interesting point about Disclosure Day is that it looks at the phenomenon as sort of not a negative thing for experiencers, but a lot of people who have gone through that type of abduction experience, that maybe it's not necessarily evil or dark, but it could be a combination, sometimes good, sometimes dark. But the Disclosure Day, they actually, you know, go into how little children seem to have, the aliens or whoever they are, seem to have an affinity for children. And I thought that part of the movie where the children actually were living the experience was phenomenal. It was on target. And he really, really did his research on that. And I think that this is an opportunity for experiencers who may have not known where to go before in their life to explain to people out of fear of ridicule, that maybe now with the release of this movie, people will say, wow, this has happened to other people. I'm not alone. And we already know that statistically last year, about 17% of our cases at MUFON were experiencer cases. And I was just told yesterday by Seth Feinstein, one of our people, that it's 33% now. That's literally, 100% jump in 2 years in experience, people submitting experiencer questionnaires to us.
That is fascinating, number one, because, the conversation has been much, much different over the last couple of years. Even the fact of the word experiencer being used. And when I first came to MUFON was the first year that I was out as Curious Realm. I'd been around as Dudes and Beer for 5 years before. After I transformed, I decided to sponsor a lot of shows like MUFON International Association of Near-Death Studies, International Remote Viewing Association, things that I highly believe in their work. I think that they are doing good work and have done good work, so I support that. And that's how I came in, and that was the year that it was in Denver, and the topic was UFOs and the media. And that year was the year that it was funny because you saw a flip from you know, oh, so-and-so being we have a UFO believer over here, folks, you know, and it being something to lampoon or, you know, like, hey, here's the guy with the tinfoil hat. And then suddenly it became UFO denier being some of the language that you heard out of the media. UFO skeptic, things like that, where it was like interesting how the media has flipped on this and turned to the side of not denying it, but saying, you know, if you're the one who's questioning it, you're the weirdo.
Yeah, it's interesting. I believe that the postmodern UFO age began when Elizondo leaked the Tic Tac video.
Absolutely.
From the Nimitz incident in 2004, an entirely new cast of characters. All of a sudden, we're not being ridiculed. And the question is, like, why now? All right. Why are the media and the government seemingly in lockstep? All right. And the only example I can give is that during World War II, the media and the government were in lockstep in a propaganda campaign against the Nazis. And there's some people that think that this may all be a big psyop, this release of different tranches of material from war.gov/UFO. But I will tell you the interesting thing is that we believe at MUFON that the focus has turned away from nuts and bolts craft to the experiencers. And it appears to me, at least, the experiencers may hold the key to what's actually going on. And when they say, who's a UFO expert? Well, in the end, it's the experiencers, because they're the ones that had the experience. They are the experts.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting to see the dialogue. And I have said since the beginning, whether you're talking whistleblower testimony in front of Congress, whether you're talking even the data that's come out from the tranches that have been put out, most of that data, most of those documents have been out for years.
And some of them are known hoaxes too.
Oh, sure, sure. And all they've done is go through and put all this stuff together in one box for you. For the average person who's not a researcher like us, Bob, who knows like, hey, go over to John Greenwald at the Black Vault, you know, go to this place, go to Curious Research, go to Curious Realm, to the archives, and you'll find, you know, documents. So they put it together for the average person who doesn't know where to go look. And good for them. Cool. But there's still a lot that's not there.
Yeah, there's still a lot that's not there. And to find the real gems in these three releases so far, you really have to dig. I mean, social media and the news have picked up videos from the third tranche of two orange luminous objects in the northeastern United States in 2025. Yep. And to us, we know that it was the drone thing in New Jersey. But the video that they actually show is just two Chinese lanterns. Okay, it's a nothing burger, this one particular video that's gone viral all over the world. And it's just paper lanterns with candles at the bottom of them. And so what are they giving us in reality? You know, there's a couple of really interesting documents, especially the ones from 1947 concerning Roswell. So there's nuggets to be found. And according to Grush, that each tranche that's released will get more and more intense. So we can only hope that we're going to start to see some real, real dynamite soon.
I hope so. I hope so. And but regardless, once again, none of this is for us. None of this is for those of us in the community. None of this is for those of us who have researched this and known these things and understood these back hallways of Congress and black budget programs for decades. This is for the other 60% of the populace that doesn't know or understand that. Like, you've got to onboard them to that somewhere, somehow, if you want to undo it. You know?
Yeah. Yep. Yep. It's going to be a wait and see game. You know,
yeah.
Is it real, or as they used to say, is it Memorex?
That's
remember
it.
The old Memorex.
Absolutely.
All right.
So. Well, and you know, with that in mind, because that's something that, especially experiencer wise, that you've really got to be careful with whenever it comes to, helping people, whenever it comes to getting people help, whenever it comes to even taking their story and how you handle the data from their story. It's got to be done with kid gloves, Bob. And I think MUFON has really put forth a great system that even a lot of other people have emulated in their own ways. You know, Enigma, IUFOB, all kinds of things as far as reporting right. systems and that kind of way. And I have always said, report to one, report to all. Because the more data we have out there, the more eyes we have out there, the better the odds are of narrowing down anomaly. We proved that 75-85% of them are fully known quantifiable things, but the ones that remain as anomaly, that's the important part. And the more data we get from people, even if it's years down the road, those can still confirm other stories. Those can still confirm long investigated cases in that kind of way.
Sure, that's why I enjoy patterns, looking for patterns, because some of these patterns persist over decades. I think that what's going on historically between UFO organizations is that we don't cooperate. Yeah. And we better start sharing our information, our databases, at least to some extent, working together, because if it's left to the all domain anomaly resolution office, Arrow of the Pentagon, or private corporations like Enigma Labs, they're going to determine what they think disclosure should be for the public. So there was a summit, a virtual summit a few months ago I participated in called the UAP Summit.
And
it's about that exactly. The keynote speaker was Richard Dolan. And basically the theme was cooperate together or go down a drain together.
That's right.
Here's the issue. If you've got all of these databases all over the place taking reports now, it's diluting the main pool. So you will never have accurate monthly statistics again unless people start working together.
That's right.
I don't think Arrow and Enigma are going to help. So it's going to be up to IUFOB, New Fork, and groups like KUFOS to carry the weight.
Yeah, precisely. And that's just it. Because the more fragmented it is, the more faceted it is in that kind of way, the more shotgun and less laser it is, you know, white light is great. It lets us see a lot of things. Lasers cut stuff and lasers require all those frequencies being cohered together and all being focused together with the same wavelength in the same lockstep. And, I think even if it comes down to the fact of an agreed upon means by which like these are the data points that we need, that kind of stuff, even if there becomes a standardization amongst the other 501c3s and companies out there that take these reports, I think that would even go a long way, much less the fact of let's find some way to be able to cross the databases, you know, and cross network them in a searchable way.
And it's with AI now, it's technically not that hard. It's a question of how much will organizations be willing to share. I didn't finish answering the one question you asked me, though, is that with MUFON, not only do we investigate UFO cases, and we have 145,000 cases currently in the database, but we actually have what we call an experiencer resource team. So for people who may be realizing for the first time, hey, there's a place I can report my experience to, MUFON is the most qualified we've had in place for years, started by Kathleen Martin, an experiencer resource group, that after we actually investigate a case, whether or not it's an experiencer case or a nuts and bolts case, with experiences, we will have a second person reach out to them with resources that we have, because sometimes this is very traumatic for people who don't understand what's happening to them. We've been in that business of helping people through experiences for decades now.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it is one of those, it's hard. It's not easy. And even deciding whether or not somebody's case needs to go to the ERT is not easy. Mm-hmm. You know, it has to pass through rungs of investigation. It has to pass through rungs of vetting, all kinds of stuff. So, and that's just it. That's just it. There is a lot that goes into investigating a case. And one of the things you actually present annually at the symposium is the cases of interest presentation,
yep.
Bob. And there are some fascinating cases out there this year. I don't want you to give away too much juice. I want people mm-hmm. to come to the conference and see things.
Mm-hmm.
But let's get into a couple of the cases if we can.
Okay, I just came across tonight that I think is fascinating. One of the things that I'm going to be presenting on the cases of interest is we've had what are called chevrons, which are like V-shaped craft mm-hmm. and triangles and boomerangs for decades. But what people are starting to share about now in their reports are that the outside of these craft seem to have patterns on them. As a matter of fact, there was in the third tranche released the other day, there was an object that was over Cheyenne Mountain. They called it the potato.
Yep.
And basically it had scales all over it. It was like a whitish object with scales all over it. And that's what we're seeing on chevrons, and we're seeing it on triangles. And it could possibly be a type of camouflage. The chevrons seem to have zebra patterns now. And if you go back to World War One, when they used to paint strange mm-hmm. things on the sides of ships to make them hard to see at sea, maybe we're witnessing some sort of camouflaging effort with these chevrons. Also, these chevrons have the ability to at least semi-cloak. And the question becomes, is it an actual cloaking mechanism, or is it possibly a U.S. spy craft that's got a camera on the roof and yep. using the bottom of the craft as a projector to make it almost seem invisible?
Yeah.
There is a chevron called the Telos. It's a spy vehicle by the United States. But the problem is we've been seeing chevrons and triangles since the 1890s. So weren't ours back then. And did we reverse engineer some sort of technology? So that's one set of cases. I'm going to be showing people actual drawings from people who have witnessed these patterned type craft. Sometimes they think it's like piping on the bottom. Very, very unusual for a craft that would be aerodynamic. Why would you have piping all over the bottom of the craft? Why would you have these scales all over the craft?
Yeah. Well, and the scales I can understand, you know, because even the fact of like it seems counterintuitive, but like dimples actually help airflow. Golf balls, right? Things
that's
like
what
that.
You're thinking. So, and the Tic Tacs also might use that technology because if they are aerogel type vehicles, they have almost no wind resistance because of the exoskeleton and the way it's made. So yeah, I absolutely agree with you on that. You can fly seamlessly through the atmosphere.
Yeah. And we've had hollow reflective panels. Like, I mean, don't get me wrong. It's been in the Marvel movies for years. It's been in all kinds of movies. I mean, it was first, I think James Bond, I think may have been the first movie to actually premiere it, but it's been a concept and been out there and been being tested for years, at least in university labs. And it's one of those, it's very, very interesting. When you start looking at the expanse to which these programs reach, Bob, when you start looking at things like the prime example that I normally give is the F-117A. Mm-hmm. When you look at the Nighthawk stealth fighter, that really premiered for its first time in Panama before the first Gulf War. We used it to go in and take out satellite installations, stuff like that. But its first real premiere was the Gulf War in 1990. You know,
and what's the new stealth fighter jet that just came out? It's white. It's a smaller version of the F-117, but we had a series of drawings that people submitted mm-hmm. that looked like they were looking at the front of a craft, but it had the two triangle windows and flared out. And what we realized is that people were looking at test flights of this new F-117 replacement. The weirdest thing, though, and everybody said it was white, and that's what the official picture. This is the picture. Yes, people are drawing that for us. That's the exact picture. The problem with this is that in the three cases we have in the MUFON CMS where people drew the front view of this plane, it's hovering. And it's silent. So unlike a Harrier jet of VTOL craft that would make a lot of noise if it was using engines to maintain vertical lift and stay in one place, these things are silent, which makes us think that maybe they do use some sort of anti-gravity propulsion system already.
Anti-gravity or even active noise cancellation systems, because you can absolutely... Like, you don't even need speakers to do that. You can use ultrasonic transducers to vibrate the plane and make the plane a speaker that transmits it to your head and vibrates the opposite sound of the engine. And then it's like Kit in Knight Rider, where he hits silent mode and it activates that same thing, where it's just like your Bose noise canceling headphones on the plane, where no music, you turn them on and suddenly it's silent because in microseconds, that chip is literally feeding back a reversal of the noise from the background onto itself to cancel it out. So all actual technologies that are out there, you know, so it could be using that.
But I can pretty much confirm that the new stealth fighters, they can hover, whether or not.
Oh, I wouldn't doubt that. Doubt that one bit. Why would you not incorporate that? You know, why would you not incorporate that within a fighter bomber in that kind of way? That's just silly. But yeah, the idea of hollow reflective panels, things like that, these things have been talked about for a long time. And once again, when you look at the longevity of black budget programs, Bob, like I think it was 68 that the Have Blue program started, that they first started trying to make the F-117A. We didn't see it till 1990.
Right.
So for 30 years, models of that thing were flying overhead. We're doing all kinds of stuff. The X-37B space plane. We heard about the first time when it landed after a year and a half long successful mission over our heads that we didn't even know about. It's an unmanned space plane that looks like a very like family minivan size space shuttle.
Yes, it does. And it's fascinating because they will never tell you what it's actually doing up there for 390 days.
Yeah, it's breaking records like 3 years up there. What the hell is it doing, man?
Right. And I'm sure the Russians and the Chinese are thinking that too.
But what's funny is even whenever you start getting into the shuttle missions, things like that, whenever you start looking at STS missions, many of those were DOD, where they did not get instruction until they were in. So they practice generalized maneuvers, like you're going to replace a part that looks like this, stuff like that. They had no idea what the satellite was or what they were doing until they were in orbit because of the DOD regulations on that kind of stuff. But it's interesting to see those kind of things, like how many shuttle missions on this civilian space agency are actively DOD.
Yeah, and you know, you could carry that into SpaceX and Elon Musk. It's like Starlink, is it just for internet? He just signed another contract, a military contract with the United States government for, I think it's called Star Shield. And essentially, I think it's like an anti-satellite killing weapon, to be perfectly honest. And we definitely have an entire network now around the globe.
Oh, yeah.
And the next phase of warfare is going to be in space. Wernher von Braun knew that back in the 1970s.
Absolutely.
The weaponization of
space. Absolutely. And that was quite literally brought up in 1952 in the Brookings Report, which you can go by and check out. I'm sure it's there on the MUFON website. It's in the archives in Curious Realm.
I think it's in Project Aquarius, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's one of those, it's kind of interesting when you start looking at it, Bob, how many things like that have been around, how many times our government has had this conversation with think tanks, how many times the think tanks have brought theologians in. Like, all of these things have been covered since the day Sputnik went beep for the first time.
The Rand Corporation, the Battelle Institute, I mean, the whole kit and caboodle there, you know?
Yeah. So other cases of interest. Let's hear about some other.
Because of my position, whenever a field investigator closes a case, I get an email that says, here's the disposition, and I'll see what the actual case was. And if I find it interesting, I can actually go back in and look at it and maybe say, hey, this isn't identified. This might be more anomalous. But I just found one before that I'm just dying to give you. It's from the United Kingdom. It's actually a historical case from 1997. And I just want to read this description from the witness. Ready? Driving from university to Weymouth in broad daylight, 6-year-old son in the back seat began kicking my driving seat, shouting, "Dad, look." Object appeared directly in front of car, hovering over the road. Stopped the car, and son and I got out and stood underneath it. That's gutsy. It was at least 5 times the width of the road and was motionless. The object was brilliant white, and its surface moved like pouring gloss white paint into a tray. That's very interesting. My girlfriend, who remained in the car, shouted for us to get back in the car and lock the doors. Son and I stood beneath it, and then it silently turned 90 degrees on its axis and shot straight up and disappeared. We reported it to the police. Of note, the sighting was close to the decommissioned Winfrey Heath nuclear power station. The shape of the craft was like liquid, like sort of liquid.
The texture of it.
White, but it was white. And that they actually went and stood underneath it blows my mind. Well, all right?
Yeah. And, you know, there's kind of that Travis Walton moment where it's like, why? Why are you? And, you know, don't get me wrong. I was doing in my old house, I was playing around with RF frequencies and magnetic fields, things like that in my home studio, to a point where, like, what I was doing destroyed my radio clock. And when my wife saw that the radio clock looked like the Predator alphabet, she was like, "What did you do?" And I told her, and she was like, "Our son's room is on the other side of that wall. This is done. Like, this is over." And I was like, but the day the portal opens, I'm walking through. Like, I just, I want you to know, like, I'm going through the portal.
Be careful. That's another, I love portals. I collect, there's two types of portals. Essentially, there's sky portals, and the majority of objects that come out of sky portals are either arrow shaped or triangular. And usually the portal, there's the glowing rectangle in the sky of white light that something comes out of or goes into. There's discolorations of the sun where the sun sort of turns an orangey red color. And there's a lot of associated vehicles that seem to appear when that happens. And the third are rainbow portals. And the last are the black clouds, where sometimes an object goes into the cloud and never comes out again. So in the sky, there's like 4 or 5 different types of portals we've identified. On the other side of the coin are the indoor portals, where people claim the wall opens up and 3 grays will come through, or as orbs and turn into entities.
Or the portical, the door opens up.
Right. You know, and a lot of them come out of the closet, I've noticed. We have a lot of reports with it. But the different types of entities are fascinating. Sometimes there's these tall, jet black entities. Sometimes it's static people. Sometimes it's actually machines coming through the wall to do something. So it's scary.
You know, it's interesting, Bob. I'm 50 years old.
I thought you were 30 something.
Thank you. I'm well pickled. I do not sleep with an open closet door. I won't. I won't. So like, literally, it will keep me up. It will keep me up. And years ago, I was in college, and there was something in my closet. I was by myself in my dorm room, man. And the closet door was open, and
I was a little kid, I had a similar.
Never again. Never again. Well, whatever's behind that door is behind that door. Cool, man. But I will never again sleep with, whatever was watching me.
I always tell people a lot of people who like want to summon an experience, they usually regret it. Okay. People who don't, and it happens to them, that more often than not is a positive experience where people felt incredible love. But it seems that whenever they're trying to pull something from wherever, it turns out to be a negative. Errol Gray Anderson was a perfect example
Thank
of that.
You.
He regretted it till the day he died.
Yeah. He is the example that I give as my good friend, Earl, because it was harrowing for him. And that's something that, let's get into that real quick, Bob. Out of the cases that you have, because you gave the number a minute ago, but out of the cases that you have that come in annually, what percentage of them are experiencer cases?
So last 2 years ago when I did the study, it was 17%. Now it's 33%, which is astonishing to me. And there's some
third.
It's a third. And I think there's probably more, and it's going to be even more after Disclosure Day and with the war.gov files coming out. But now, people are realizing, hey, I've got a place to go to report this. So I believe we're going to see an incredible spike in the
now,
next few
out
months.
Out of those experiencer cases, Bob, I guess let's ask this question real quick for the general listening audience who may not be familiar with MUFON, things like that. At what point does a case CE-wise, as far as contact, what rings it up as being an experiencer case?
There's so many similarities in these cases, Chris. It's like these people are experiencing the same thing, whether it's Australia or Michigan or whatever. These people are experiencing the same types of activity, no matter where in the world. And it's decades. So the question is it nefarious? Is it all nefarious? Is it all good? Or is it somewhere in the middle? That's the way we look at it. But
But I guess the question I'm asking, though, is at what point of a sighting, I saw a craft, there were little critters inside of it. Is that an experiencer? As far as seat close encounter, the first kind, second kind, third kind, fifth kind, like we're talking about CE5 experience, is human initiated contact. You know, so the whole idea of seeing a craft, being in proximity of craft, being taken aboard craft, and then CE4, which is being abducted and experimented on, that kind of stuff. And then five, which is, hey, I would like an experience. Please give it to me. So at what point amongst those things does a case become an experiencer case?
It's interesting.
MUFON regimen.
In our new system, we're coming out with a new database next month. It's called the Andrus database. It's an acronym that I can't even repeat. It's the automated something system, but it's named after Walt Andrus. And we're going to step up the criteria for what counts as a category 1, 2, or 3 case. And it depends on if there's physical evidence, different types of things, patterns that we can correlate. But the problem with a lot of experiencer cases is that there's no trace evidence. Almost none, ever. So how do you quantify that? And the simple answer is you can't, except through patterns, looking to see if similar things are going on within a similar area over a short period of time, like a flap. And that's the way you actually have to do it. Personally, I think that of all of the experiencer cases we do get, I'd say probably 70% are negative experiences. But I will tell you one interesting thing we did research on just recently. When people submit an experiencer case to us, they fill out what's called the experiencer questionnaire, and they're asked 25 questions. These were developed by Kathleen Martin. They asked things like, do abductions run in your family? Was it a positive experience? Were you healed? Were you injured? Did you suddenly have cravings for salt afterwards, which people have. What type of blood type are you? And what we found was that in question 16, which is healings, and question 17, which is injuries, about 3,000 people each answered those questions, and about 300 of them responded, yes, I was injured, or no, I was healed, almost to within one case of each other, which I found astonishing. And we found out that most healings take place at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. All right. Whereas the more nefarious ones take place after midnight. And we also found that the top state for healings is Arizona, and the top state for injuries to people during an experience is Pennsylvania.
Wow. Pennsylvania.
I don't know.
Pennsylvania.
A lot of cave systems, a lot of Bigfoot, a lot of cave systems. Who knows, right?
Yeah. Interesting. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't expect that. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't expect that. You know, you'd think a state like California or Oregon or somewhere like that with possibly even more sightings. I'd tend to think that the Pennsylvania is not
Pennsylvania's in the top five for cases everywhere. Oh yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Washington, California, Pennsylvania, Arizona, and there's one more I can't think, but they're consistently always at the top.
Oh wow.
California, Arizona, Pennsylvania, New York is the other one.
Okay. Yeah. And you know, amongst these cases, especially experiencer cases, things like that, like you said, a third, if not greater, depending mm-hmm. on, because you know, it's kinda like those numbers for hashtag Me Too, things like that. Those are nowhere near real numbers mm-hmm. because we know good and well there's a lot of people that haven't reported their instances.
Absolutely. For every case reported, there's probably 20.
So if you think the numbers are horrifying, they're way more horrifying than what's actually reported and what's out there. So if you think a third of cases, a mm-hmm. third, man, a third mm-hmm. of the cases that come to you guys are actual experiencer cases where people have had contact or been in presence mm-hmm. in some kind of way. And that is fascinating, Bob. To think about that's a massive amount.
And I would think that if New Fork did a study, I bet they come up with a similar number. That's just my gut. I'd like to talk to them about it. Actually,
I am literally gobsmacked by that. That is, I'd have figured one of five. You know, mm-hmm. maybe a 20%. The 17 you were talking. Mm-hmm. I thought like absolutely. That sounds like right in the range. Right in the sweet spot, but good Lord, to see that in the last 2 years that it's spiked to what you're talking about is a massive seed change. That is huge when it comes to that. And how many out of those, just out of curiosity, how many of those report CE5 as being part of their experience?
Yeah, it's...
Because that would be a really interesting dive into that 33% would be to mm-hmm. see how many of that 33% waved the flag of invitation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And whether or not their experience was on a binary scale, positive or negative, mm-hmm. you know,
I always tell people don't look for trouble. If you get invited on a trip, don't go. All right, because they may tell you you're coming back and you might not.
I will tell you right now, as a herpophile and a reptile friend, I just chased a snake in my backyard yesterday, man. I'm 50 years old and I can't not try to catch the friendly snake when I see it. But if mm-hmm. you want to get bit by a snake, feel free to go looking for snakes.
That's right.
Feel free to go turning over rotting logs and rocks and think you will find a snake.
Sure. I live in a forest. We have in Pennsylvania, we have small rattlesnakes.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're poisonous. Well, you can hear them under the rock.
Yeah. Yeah. Know? And if you leave them alone, even if you walk near them, if you leave them alone, you're all right. You go digging for them and unroost where they're at. Something else may happen. You know, that's when trouble comes about because you went looking and that's really the thing. We even got into that this last week with our guest, the idea of what are you putting out there? Are you putting that out there in that kind of way? So you really do have to wonder. And even, even as an investigator, if you're going out to a local hot spot, something like that, like try not to go down rabbit holes of videos of the hot spot, things like that. Like you are literally putting those tropes into your head to just go back to the beginning of the conversation with how Steven Spielberg showed that, yes, entities can use those tropes in your head.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe not for what you want.
Yeah, you know? I mean, it's not only dangerous for whistleblowers and stuff. Well, I don't know if you knew Fred Saluga. He was our West Virginia state director. He went and investigated a case in Ohio last year, and he got he went into a radioactive area in the state park, and he's dead now. He got radioactivity related cancer. So I tell people, It's not the safest thing to just go, hey, there was a UFO over there. Let's go look. All right.
Yeah.
It can be deadly. All right.
Hey, and you have to be
careful.
It did much like doing any Sasquatching, even just casual hiking, rock hounding is a huge one that gets people into trouble because you cross property lines.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're talking about taking minerals off people's property and things like that. It gets hairy. Hairy.
Where I live, all the trees are painted purple. That means no trespassing. Don't go there.
Yeah,
I don't know that purple trees.
I was gonna say. Thank God you know that.
Yeah, they can shoot you. All right, that's a warning.
Hey,
purple trees are a warning.
That's just it. And the last thing you want to find out is how those laws work, the wrong way. But. With that in mind, Bob, when we're talking experiencers, when we are talking those who are coming to MUFON for help in that kind of way,
mm-hmm.
How often do you ever deal with the families of experiencers, things like that? Is it something that I don't know if the ERT talks to family members, that kind of stuff, but
they will. If a person fills out the questionnaire and mentions that it's abductions run in the family, if the family is willing to speak with us, we will get everybody's testimony. But because it happens a lot with mothers and daughters generationally, so that's a pattern in and of itself. But yes, if the family is willing to talk to us, we'll talk to the whole family, and usually they'll find out other interesting characteristics of, you know, sightings that Aunt Mary had too, you know, along the way. So,
yeah. Now, one of the other cases of interest, one of the other things that you're talking about, which has been all over the news, things like that, Bob, is the missing scientists, the scientists that have been connected to all kinds of wild research, all kinds of various agencies, various alphabet agencies, all kinds of things. So I don't want you, once again, as we say in broadcast, you know, don't squeeze all the juice.
I'm not
going
to squeeze all the juice. Yes,
but definitely squeeze the Charmin here. Let's talk a little bit about this, because this is something that is fascinating. And out there, and there is a lot of good stuff and a lot of trash amongst these stories. And it's interesting to go into it. But get into a little bit of these connected scientists and military folk that are connected to the world of UFO UAP research.
Sure. So in February, and a lot of this came out right after the Trump-Obama back and forth about did Obama give away secret information, and all of a sudden Trump is going to release the files. And his daughter-in-law says, oh, well, he may actually give a speech sometime in the summer about UFOs. A lot of people think it might be the 79th anniversary of Roswell. But right after he made the announcement about what war.gov is going to be releasing stuff – General William McCaslin just walked out into the desert in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and has not been seen since. He left his phone behind, but he took a gun. So was it to commit suicide, or did he get the call, it's time to go to the safe house, which is what I think happened. The girl on the right, unfortunately, they just found her body. She walked out into the desert, wiped her phones before she did it, but all indications were she was just having a normal day before that. And she told her husband he's going to have to find a way home that night. She dropped lunch off for her daughter, went home, her phones were wiped. She was not seen again until maybe 3 weeks ago, where they found her skeletonized body off a trail, only an hour north of where McCaslin disappeared. And that's basically what I'm going to be going into at the symposium, is look at the dates. Look at Monica Reza on the left. She worked for McCaslin. She was hiking in Angeles National Forest, and she disappeared on June 22nd. Melissa Cassais disappeared on June 26th, okay, 4 days apart. McCaslin disappeared right after the Trump announcement. So you start to get the feeling that maybe there's something going on. And just quickly, I'm going to show you a couple of slides. Yeah, unfortunately, they just found her. But Amy Eskridge, she died by suicide in Huntsville, Alabama. Joshua LeBlanc, he burned to death to a crisp. They couldn't even identify his body. In Huntsville, Alabama. Carl Grillmayer, I'll go into him later, Caltech professor. He was working on deep space sensors looking for signatures of liquid water and industrial pollution on exoplanets, suggesting an alien civilization. A random guy just went up on his porch and shot him. Okay, and just this map shows the proximity of where a lot of this is happening. Monica Reza and several other people were connected to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, and that's a very interesting story in and of itself. Livelsberger blew himself up in a Tesla, claiming he was an anti-gravity propulsion whistleblower. Amy Eskridge apparently was working on anti-gravity propulsion. Like Joshua LeBlanc in Huntsville, Alabama, he burned to a crisp in a Tesla. All right. Another guy was going to testify for Eric Burleson at the second congressional hearings. He died of an overdose. And this guy, Cole Allen, and I can't give it away, so I'm going to stop sharing, but the guy that tried to shoot Trump is connected to all of this. All right. He was attending Caltech, where Grillmayer, the guy that got shot in the face, taught. And he also interned at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. I don't think anybody has put this together that, you know, Monica Reza was from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. You know, he interned there. A lot of these scientists were connected to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. So is it really possibly about anti-gravity propulsion systems? And just like they did with the Nazi scientists back in World War II, when Die Glock, the Bell, was about to be overrun by the Allies, they killed all of the scientists that were working on it. I hope that's not what's going on here. But, I mean, this is sinister all the way up to the president of the United States possibly being an assassination attempt in April because of something connected to these missing scientists. And that's what I'm going to be talking about at the symposium.
You know, and it's interesting, once again, the timing of all this and some of these cases. And there have been NASA scientists. There was like a spat for a few years of NASA scientists that were dying in weird ways, where it was like if you looked at the odds and the number of like actual scientists employed by NASA and the number of people that died, last thing you'd do is go get a job as a NASA scientist, because the odds, it was like a 10% chance that you were going to die. Yeah. And it was like, what is this? This is just weird. But what it reminds me of, man, I'm a huge rock and roll fan, you know, spent years doing rock and roll, but it reminds me of the bassist for Iron Butterfly, Philip Taylor Kramer, who disappeared.
I don't know this story.
He disappeared in 1995 after a series of distressing phone calls, as it says, where he told people that he was going to kill himself. The remains of his van were found much later. Stuff like that. Here's the wild thing. And this is just, you know, this is like Brian May status rock and roll stuff, where it's like, oh, Brian May, you know what he does for his day job? He's a freaking astrophysicist, you know? No. When you start looking at life under a rock, highly successful career with Northrop Grumman in the development of MX nuclear missile guidance systems. And that's how he disappeared. How he disappeared.
Hey, do you know who Jack Parsons is?
Yes.
Jack Parsons started the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. He died building a rocket in his living room, apparently, and blew himself up. But his friends, all right, he belonged to something called the Lodge. And the Lodge was actually this sort of demonic occultist group that Aleister Crowley ran with L. Ron Hubbard of Scientology.
Yeah.
And that plays into the jet propulsion angle.
It plays into more than that, man. It plays directly into Lamb. And we did not have
Lamb.
Yeah. We didn't have really until Lamb and Aleister Crowley and all that kind of stuff. We didn't really have the idea of grays as far as aliens that we had. Most people talked about aliens being robots and that kind of stuff. Even in Hollywood, it was robots and everything else. But it was through the summoning and a series of summonings, part of which took place, interestingly enough, in Manhattan at Central Park West, same location that inspired Ghostbusters. It's the same cult of people that were worshiping an ancient god trying to bring about the end of the world. And that's what they were trying to do, was trying to open a portal and bring in Cthulhu and change the whole world and stuff like that. So, like, all of that is based on actual summonings by Crowley and Parsons and all that kind of stuff. But but when you get into that and start looking at Lamb, it is absolutely wild, man.
I know you're trying to find a picture of Lamb. I mean, he does look like a gray, and we're going back how far? How many decades?
Yeah.
With Crowley and Lamb.
Yeah. No, and that is straight up to the 1940s. You know? So it is really interesting when you start getting into that, when you start getting into the connection of disappearing scientists, because it's not a new trend.
No. Hey, Malaysia Flight 370?
Yeah.
That had 20 scientists on it, sensor-oriented scientists. I mean, Israel's been taking the Mossad's been taking out Iranian scientists for decades. Okay. So this is the Nazis with Die Glock. It's like, this has been going on for decades, if not centuries. The guy that invented Diesel, his last name was Diesel, at the beginning of World War One, I think they threw him off a ship. All right. It's like dangerous inventing things.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just strange when you start looking at the way that all these things and beyond the point of apophenia, you know, which is there's pareidolia, which is where you see patterns in things, you know, you see something familiar like a face in a cloud or in rocks, that kind of stuff. But then there's apophenia where you see connections. And this is like the source of conspiracy theories, that kind of stuff, where you start making connections between things that are not there because of the patterns.
I hope I don't do that. I think I'm finding real patterns, but God forbid apophenia, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And but that's just it. And here's Lamb right there. And it's just wild. It's absolutely wild because, yeah, it is once again tied right up around to the same time as Roswell and all that kind of stuff. So and it feeds into this whole question that's going on right now that was even brought up in Disclosure Day. Are they all evil? Is it, you know, and I have held for the longest time on this show, Bob, to the point that I have a rote turn of phrase when I present, when I talk on this show or other shows, and that is, I believe that there is a large hominid being in the woods of North America known as Sasquatch. But I also think that there is something else that is firmly willing to use the trope of our mind and our want of experience as a point of ingress to this dimension. No different than leaving the window open for the vampire, stuff like that.
Absolutely. I believe if a lot of times these bedroom encounters, the entities that enter, and there's all different types, it's just not little grays, like I mentioned before, they use tools. A lot of them use different types of tools. And I always ask the question, would demons use tools if this was demonic? And my answer is maybe, maybe not. But what do you think about that?
Well, you know, it's interesting because to an extent, sure. No different than the djinn. In ancient literature, if you go back into the world of Solemnic magic, things like that, there were definite tools that the djinn used, that kind of stuff, like the worm that was given to Solomon to build the temple.
I don't know that story.
Yeah. It was given to him by the djinn because he was given a ring by the archangel Michael. That gave him control over all of the djinn and angels and spirits and elementals and stuff like that. And he commanded the demon to actively give him a tool to build the temple, to build the first temple of Solomon. And he gave him a small caterpillar. It was like this caterpillar that like chewed its way through and like built the bricks.
Really?
And then the djinn lifted the bricks into place because he wasn't allowed to build the temple himself.
Wow.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's a fascinating story, man.
It's
crazy, but it's there, you know? And when you start looking at that, when you start considering that, when you start considering, like I just talked to my friend Nathaniel Gillis today. He comes on our show. He talks about what his research he is calling necronetics, which is basically what seems to be a race of beings that has been using humanity as a shell for generations since the dawn of time and using basically a form of like Solemnic magic and sigil magic in that kind of way, a magical tools to basically soul exchange us. And use us to progenerate their species and things like that. So it's interesting. It's very much in the world of hybrid alien program, that kind of thing, but goes back way before that into the world of sorcery, into the world of, you know, raising the dead in ancient times and stories of that. It's really fascinating. And when you start thinking about that, when you start considering the fact of, is there something, and those same things don't play by our rules, you know, it's kind of like you think that God doesn't like the devil till the devil pops up in the middle of the heavenly court in Job. And it's like, whoa, what's that about?
Right. Yeah.
How's that happening? That just kind of rocked my boat. Didn't think he was allowed up in that place.
No, yeah, he's free to come and go. And so he argues with God.
And
a
that's
lot.
Just it. There are different rules that they play by that we are not necessarily consensually bound by in that kind of way. When you think about that, and when you think about the fact of, if you're not consensually bound, that explains, especially if some of them are possibly demons, if some of the alien abductions are possibly demons, then yeah, that could explain the fact that, you know, you don't give your permission. It doesn't matter if you give your permission. However, the second that you invoke the name of Christ, it stops.
Absolutely. Do you know the guy? He's a state section director in Florida, Joe Jordan.
I know Joe Jordan well. Joe Jordan and I will probably be interviewing him at the upcoming July 4th UFO Roswell UFO Festival.
Oh, okay.
I'll be seeing him there. He's been on the show there before. Yeah.
But he asked me to speak 3 years ago in Florida, which I did. And I was sort of like, I'm always the nuts and bolts guy. Yeah. But he brought up like 10 experiences who testified that when they called out the name of Christ,
yep,
the abduction ended instantly, which I find fascinating.
And you know, that I had heard that on Coast to Coast years and years mm-hmm. ago, numerous times.
Mm-hmm.
From guests, that kind of stuff. And it's interesting because it does kind of bring to light a lot of what we're talking about, you know, mm-hmm. when you start getting into interdimensional beings, the qualities of some of these things, the fact of being able to phase in and out of them, you know, like the experience that was explained. I heard it explained at MUFON and then heard the exact same case explained by Hal Puthoff at the IRVA convention in California about the person going up, touching the craft and passing through it, mm-hmm. you know? So it explains so many different things. And when you start considering that, when you start thinking about that, you know, it's like, I'll be talking about at the symposium. There's a reason why since quantum entanglement winning the Nobel Prize, why science is now rapidly running to the paranormal
mm-hmm.
in all fronts. It's mm-hmm. fascinating to see.
And I think the data centers have something to do with this too. It's like, I can't see a trillion times larger need for AI for people like you and me. They're trying to compute something. And I think it's pretty dangerous.
See, here's where apophenia gets dangerous, Bob.
Okay.
Because seeing the pattern there of, well, wait a minute, if all these things aren't actual things and they're like, you know, drones and stuff like that coming in, and they're non-human intelligences in that kind mm-hmm. of way, well, sure, you'd need a whole lot of AI, you mm-hmm. know, to be able to talk with those things and do what they need to do and understand the way that they need to be understood. All kinds of things. So when you start considering that, and then the mass number of data centers going up everywhere and the way that they're heating up the ground around
like
them
that.
And everything else, you're talking terraforming, man. Like, they're turning Earth into their home now. Like,
I hope not.
You see what I mean? Like, that's mm-hmm. exactly how easy it is. And it's
right.
kind of frightening that's exactly mm-hmm. how easy it is to put those kind of things together and go, oh, wow. Yeah. Man, I could see how 8% of people could dive down that rabbit hole for an afternoon. We as investigators have a lot of onus put upon us, especially sure. whenever we run across experiencers, Bob. We have a lot of responsibility placed on
us. Bias,
sure.
investigator bias plays a part. Yeah.
Huge
part. We're all guilty of that because we're human.
Yeah.
So it's like, that's always like one of the first courses we give new field investigators in MUFON University is don't lead the witness. All right.
Yep.
It's everything's got to be objective.
Yeah, exactly. Bob, I want to thank you as always for coming on, for breaking these things down, for getting into the topics and the cases of interest, because it's going to be a great presentation this year. Mm-hmm. I can't wait to see all of it. It's going to be awesome. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to A, report their sighting or report their encounter or experience, where they can go to become a member, and where they can go to get their tickets for the upcoming MUFON Symposium over my birthday weekend. August.
Happy birthday.
Over the August 28th weekend, the 27th through the 29th. There in Covington, Kentucky. So, or 27th to the 30th. Sorry.
So the 27th is field investigator training. That's pretty much a closed session.
Ooh, awesome.
It's only for people who want to learn how to become a field investigator. The real public events begin on Friday, the 28th, with our banquet. Then all day Saturday and all day Sunday speakers. We also have private, not filmed experiencer workshops, and I think they're going to be filling up this year quick. Our keynote Friday night at the banquet's Peter Robbins, who's been in ufology for 50 years. Our Saturday keynote is Alex Dietrich. She was one of the crew members with David favor during the Nimitz Tic Tac incident. Yep. Stacy Wright, our Arizona state director, will be MC. Mark St. Germain is from Canada, a former MUFON national director. Klaus Vaughn is from Sweden. Katie Page, we all know. It's just going to be fantastic. All right. Covington, Kentucky Center.
Hey, there's
August
me.
27th. There you are. That's right. Richard Beckwith. And we are also having a Saturday night cruise up and down the Cincinnati River with dinner. So that's going to be great. If you see something or you feel you've been abducted, just go to MUFON.com. In the upper right-hand corner of our website, you will find the file a UFO report or an abduction button. To become part of the mission, simply go to MUFON.com/join. For as little as $6 a month, you get a beautiful monthly journal. Enhanced members also get MUFON TV with 800 original programs, and everybody, no matter what level, gets access to the 145,000 case database that is searchable. So it really is worth the money. So I look forward to seeing you in August, and you know, we'll catch up there.
I can't wait. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be fantastic. Bob, thank you as always for the open and candid conversation. It's always great catching up with you, my friend. Do hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience for the show. While you are online, everybody, checking out everything from MUFON over at MUFON.com, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. CuriousRealm.com/videos is where you can go to find all of the video channels of our guests, including MUFON there on YouTube. We have all of their YouTubes embedded. You can like and follow and subscribe to their channels, which we highly encourage you to do. We also encourage you to visit that link to curiousresearch.org, where you can get your copy of the Field Observation and Encounter Log. If you are an investigator in the world of UFO UAPs, if you are a if you are an investigator in the world of cryptozoology, paranormal, if you are a biologist or a geologist out in the field, the Field Observation and Encounter Log is your way to write down your data from occurrences in the field in a scientific way so that your data is always ready to shake hands with science come the day that you need to do so. Thank you, as always, everybody, for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit GroundZeroPlus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious, and remember, the other side is always watching.